You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Sonia Kennebec. Sonia is the director and producer of a wonderful new film that you have to see called National Bird. And the National Bird happens to be a drone. Sonia Kennebec is an independent documentary filmmaker and investigative journalist with more than 15 years of directing and producing experience. She's directed 8 television documentaries and more than 50 investigative reports. She lives in New York, where she runs a production company called 10 Forward Films that makes films about international politics and human rights. Filmmaker Magazine recently selected her as one of the, quote, 25 new faces of independent film 2016. Sonia Kennebec received a master's in international affairs from American University and was born in Malacca, Malaysia. National Bird is her first feature-length documentary film, and it is a great one, and it is the best one I've seen in recent years. You can find it at nationalbirdfilm.com, and it opens in New York City on what I call Armistice Day, and some of you call Veterans Day, November 11th, and the next week in Los Angeles, and following that around the United States. Sonia Kennebec, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David, for having me.
Great to have you, and it was great to see this film. I've seen so many great and one lousy fictional films about drone warfare, and here was a truth-telling documentary with people who had participated in drone warfare and people who had been on the receiving end of the missiles in Afghanistan. There are three Americans that you really feature who participated in the drone program, and you just use their first names in the film. One is Heather. Can you tell us a little bit about her story? The film opens with this story, and I thought it was very powerful.
Yeah, Heather was the first protagonist who I found for this film. I started out wanting to do a film about the U.S. drone war. So I started my research by really wanting to make a film about the subject matter that I think is very, very important to be discussed publicly. And so my goal, though, was not to interview, you know, talking heads and people behind desks, other journalists or book authors, but I really wanted to interview the people directly impacted by the drone war, the people who are fighting the war, who are part of the drone program in the U.S., but also, very, very importantly, the people in the target countries who are the victims and survivors of the drone war. So I really wanted to make a film about the human side of the drone war. And when I set out and started doing the research, I did realize it was very complicated because the people who work in the drone program all have top secret clearances. So they are very, very cautious to talk to the media and the public, and it is a secret program, and we just had to be very, very careful during production. And so I first found Heather, that was about a year before she published an article in The Guardian, an op-ed. And she, when I found her, she had just left the military. I saw a photograph online on, I think it was a veterans or activist forum or so, and I had been, you know, looking and reading a lot online and contacting people that I knew in the veterans and activist communities. I've been doing stories about the military and veterans and trauma for a very long time. So I started contacting the people that I know, and then on one of these sites, I saw a photograph of a young woman who covered up most of her face with a sheet of paper, and it said something like, on the sheet of paper, something like, not everything you hear about the drone war is true, I know what I'm talking about. And I was wondering if this, it was obviously a woman, I could see her eyes, if this young woman really knows about a drone program, or if she just held a sheet of paper up for someone else. And then I did detective work to find her because it was posted by someone else who said he doesn't know her. And I cross-referenced people. I was like looking where they live in the country. And I came across, eventually, a small profile photograph on Facebook of Heather. And I recognized her eyes. And I contacted her and I said, I saw this photo of a young woman who said she knows about the drone war. Holding up the sheet of paper, is that you? Do you know about the drone war? And she responded, yes, I worked in the drone program. And I asked her, do you want to meet? And she was in Pennsylvania. At that time, she had moved in, back with her family after she left the military. And I drove out there and met with her. And our first meeting, she actually told me that she lost three of her former colleagues, airmen, to suicide. And that was not known to me and not known publicly, really, that, there was a problem with suicide and trauma in the drone program.
Yeah, and Heather herself suffers from PTSD, according to the film, even according to the military. She suffers from PTSD and I would say from what many people call moral injury as well, which are things that people don't usually think of as veterans of drone piloting suffering from. They think of those things as afflicting people who go off to distant wars in person.
Yes, and in this film, and I'm also, no one is trying to compare the experiences and the trauma that military personnel, like combat veterans, suffer from after, being deployed in war zones, to the trauma that people who work in the drone program suffer from. I think, there are a lot of differences, but there is. It is real that people in the drone program can, get PTSD, can get moral injury, and it might be a different type too. It has a lot to do with guilt. It has a lot to do with actually not being in danger and not being able to justify killings with, self-defense, but that they are in complete safety and fighting the war from very far away. And then also, I think from my experiences talking to the people who've worked in the drone program, there is an issue. The human mind, struggles with this schizophrenia of going into a, like very secret environment and fighting a war and really killing people, sometimes many people, and then after your shift, after your 12-hour shift, you go home and go to Walmart or Starbucks and then home to your families and stay with your kids. And, and you can't talk about your experiences. And you're not with people all the time who have, who share these same experiences, like, combat troops who are deployed in war zones. So I think there are very different challenges, and it's a different type of trauma, and it's very important, I think, for the military to be aware of that, to do research, to discuss it, and to provide help to the veteran.
Or stop murdering people all over the world. That would work too. The thing about the top secret clearance that comes up in the film is that Heather, for example, is not even allowed to talk to therapists unless they have top secret clearance, or to talk with loved ones about what she's going through. It seems like this makes it infinitely harder on these people, doesn't it?
I think it makes it, very difficult to, to heal from trauma if you can't talk to anyone about it and you can't get help and you struggle with, all of these experiences yourself. And as Heather's grandfather and also her mother say in the film, the grandfather says that I think it's, our responsibility as a country, if we send these young people into war, to also take care of them when they return home. And in the case of Heather, that definitely did not happen. And that's the reason she decided to take the risk of, speaking out publicly. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to become a whistleblower and, especially with this type of trauma, and to, expose yourself in this way. And but all of them are doing it and taking the risk, which, are not small risks, to provide information to the public, to they are patriots, I think, doing that to really raise awareness for these issues, and also very, very importantly, to raise awareness for the people in the target countries who are civilians who are being killed and maimed by drone warfare. And yes, I think in what you were saying earlier, there's also another solution. My protagonist Lisa says, her goal is it to take the bombs of the drones, and it is a new type of warfare it's one of these times where technology has outpaced, I think, our rules and laws and regulations and even our sort of moral framework. And that's why I made this film, because it's important, I think, to discuss this type of warfare, the way we wage war. And I'm not telling people what to think. I think, this is very multi-layered. It's always gray. But I am providing transparency and information for all of us, for the public, to talk about this and discuss if this is the type of warfare that we want.
Yeah, I actually don't want any types of warfare. Film is a wonderful film. It's at nationalbirdfilm.com. You can find out where and when it's playing. We're speaking with the director, Sonia Kennebec. One of your protagonists, you mentioned, Lisa, also goes to Afghanistan and meets with family members of victims of drone strikes that on February 21st, 2010, killed 23 innocent men, women, and children. And you actually managed to get a hold of a transcript of how the participants in the drone program were talking to each other in making the decision about whether to launch these strikes and kill these people, and who was being cautious and who was gung-ho and seemingly thirsty for blood. And it strikes me as even more powerful a video than the collateral damage video that's been so widely seen, although you just had the transcript and you recreated the video footage, if I understand that right. Is that mm-hmm. is that what you did in the film?
Yes, I had the transcript, which to my knowledge is the only transcript of the radio traffic of a drone crew that has been released to the public. It was part of, or is part of, a 2,000-page investigation file into this attack on the civilian families that killed so many people. And this investigation file was classified, but the ACLU managed to get it released to the public through a Freedom of Information Act request. And I specifically chose to cover this strike and speak to the families affected by, this specific attack, because it is so well documented. I really wanted to, have a case that is, beyond doubt, because, there are many people who are out there and who might, doubt the witness statements of, the victims and survivors. And in this specific case, I have not only the video, this transcript of the drone crew, that is just trigger happy, throughout these, hours of surveillance and watching these families, but also the investigation file includes interviews with, almost everyone involved, and the military personnel, but also the victims and survivors, and even their medical records. I have the medical records of all of the people whom I interviewed in Afghanistan. So I think this, makes a very, very strong case, and in showing we can cover from all sides what has happened. And so the reenactment is the reenactment of the voices, but it, the transcript is read verbatim. And it's the parts that I chose are completely representative. They are very, very trigger happy in the transcript. And throughout 80 pages, it was hard for me to even select parts because there are so many instances where the crew is trigger happy. And then I based the video reenactment on information from the file that included screenshots, included maps, included screenshots of the drone video, even photographs of the aftermath of the burned out cars that were the cars and then the bodies, the people who were bombed. And we've recreated it to a lot of detail. We even used almost the same cars that had been misliked.
It's very, very powerful. I assume the U.S. military has in its possession transcripts and videos from every drone strike it's engaged in. And yet, if I understand correctly, we don't have any of those videos and we only have this one transcript. Is that right?
To my knowledge, that is right. And I actually tried through my own Freedom of Information Act request to get the video or the voice recording. And I got some, interesting answers. First they said, it's classified. And I said, well, the transcript has been released, so why can't you release, the voice recording? That cannot be classified anymore. And then they couldn't find the files that I was looking for and I was asking for. So, there's a lot of secrecy surrounding the drone program, and I don't think it's right. I understand that with certain national security matters where you have to protect technology, you have to protect troop movements and all that, that you need secrecy. But you're also in a democracy for things that are important for the public to know and to decide. To make decisions and voting and getting politically involved and even for the politicians themselves to get that information, transparency is important. Accountability is very important. And I think we have to know, how effective the drone war really is. How many civilians are being killed? How many people are being killed overall? In what countries? That is all information that I think the public has to know.
I couldn't agree more. In the movie, you show the transcript to Heather, the young woman we were talking about earlier, who I guess was not in on this operation. But during the transcript, you have these operators, these pilots at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada talking about the need to hurry up and kill people. And people in another office, which was where Heather had also worked, indicating that they thought there were children and they needed to be more cautious. And Heather says that she was on that side of the conversation numerous times and that the pilots she was dealing with at Creech always wanted the go-ahead to kill, whereas it was her job to say, those are children, those are civilians, etc. That suggests that this was not a unique incident, that this was something that the people in your film had lived through repeatedly.
Yes, I would say so as well, and that's the reason, you really see Heather get so emotional when she is reading the transcript. And she says on the film, from what she saw in the transcript, she wasn't involved in any of that. But she, being very good in her job and having, all this training, she, based on that transcript, she can really analyze a lot of things that went wrong. And I think for us as as people watching this and reading and getting all this information, you can even see that a lot of the mistakes that happen come through the distance. That people are sitting in the U.S. in safety and fighting a war halfway across the world. They don't know the cultural context. that is important to know to, you know, to make a correct analysis. They have this two-dimensional video. Danny McChrystal, you know, points it out that, you know, we always have to understand. You think you know what's going on when you see a video, but it's only a two-dimensional, you know, depiction of something. And in another place in the film, Heather actually says, and same as Lisa, you know, they're talking about bombs being dropped on houses, buildings, or as the military says, compounds. Do you really know who is inside that building? Do you know who you are killing? And in many of these countries that are, especially in these very rural, religious, Muslim areas, women don't leave the houses all the time. So even if you watch a house for, you know, a couple of hours or so and see people, you know, entering and leaving, do you really know with 100% certainty who is inside? So there, I think there are many, many issues that, you know, are very, very important to be discussed. And one thing that is also just important to me to mention, because when you said, you know, you talked about Lisa earlier, so there's this protagonist, Lisa, in my film, who actually goes and travels, goes on a trip and travels to Afghanistan to find out what happened on the ground, to really get the full story. And I think this is, you know, I really respect her decision, because it is, she's flying into a war zone. She is, you know, she's taking on a large risk, but what she is doing is, she's trying to bridge that gap that technology has created, and really, you know, brings humanity back into this whole picture. And it was very important for me from the beginning to show that side, to show and tell the stories of the victims and the survivors in a very respectful way. And they were so open to share their stories with us, and actually happy to tell the world community, you know, what has happened to them.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible service that you've done helping them tell people. I hope it helps them, and I hope it helps Heather and the other veterans to know that people are seeing this film. But I also think the contrast between this reality of what people actually see on a screen in little green blobs and how decisions are actually made with the fantasy that's given to us by fictional films like a film called Eye in the Sky is very valuable, because in that film you actually do have a little camera inside a house. You actually do know who is in the house. You can see them in high definition 3D video. You know their biographies and their stories, and that they actually are an imminent threat to someone. You know, not an imminent threat to the United States of America, of course, but as Barack Obama's, you know, criteria require, but they actually are an imminent threat, and they actually can't be arrested and so forth. Whereas in reality, none of these criteria seem to have ever been met by an actual non-fictional drone kill operation. How did you see Eye in the Sky, and did you like it any better than I did?
I saw Eye in the Sky. When you're just describing these, you know, these depictions, I also have to think about the Air Force commercials. I'm showing two of them in the film as well. And those commercials are also very highly produced. They look like, you know, a Hollywood trailer or a trailer for a video game. And it's all, you know, it's beyond any doubt, you know, drones are killing terrorists, and there are, you know, there's, you know, they're protecting American troops and lives, and it does, you know, I mean, drones are being used as well to do overwatch for troops, and you know, that application exists. And actually, drones, and, you know, some of my protagonists say that in the film, they can be used for something really good, like search and rescue operations after natural disasters. But in war, it's definitely not as clean and clear-cut as these Hollywood films portray. And but in my mind, and I've talked to, you know, many of the protagonists in my film and other drone whistleblowers whom I know, is it's not just about the technology and, you know, the clarity of the images and, you know, what's possible, you know, through technology, because technology will and is evolving very, very quickly. And we will, I'm very certain, you know, we will have all of these, you know, technologies that these weapons and surveillance devices that are being shown in films like Eye in the Sky. And they might even exist already, and there are probably, you know, a number of reasons why, you know, some of them are not used yet. You know, there is HD video, but it's, you know, it's the quality of the video currently is limited by bandwidth, especially if you want to have more drones in the sky. You know, you have to reduce the quality of the video. But all of these are problems that will be solved. I think the thing that still needs to be discussed is, you know, in how far do, you know, it, I, you know, like we have all these boundaries that are being crossed now with the drone war. I went to an event in Washington, D.C. during my research, and an Air Force officer was saying, well, you know, with drones, it's a very new and exciting weapon, and, you know, nation lines don't exist for us anymore. And that's a really far-reaching comment because it questions our whole political system, the way our world is organized. And, you know, where is that going to lead, you know, when all of these weapons proliferate, and drones are already proliferating. Almost close to 90 countries have armed and unarmed drones currently already, and armed drones are proliferating very, very strongly. And so, you know, that is one of the issues. You know, what do borders mean for us? You know, drones are already used for surveillance, and you know, other things in the U.S. As well. There have been some reports about that already in the papers. And then, you know, the dimension of the lack of cultural context, the war application, that it's very, very easy to use them. I think, General Hayden said that you're not losing political capital. And Daniel says in my film, it's so easy, and drones make it so easy to wage wars. So these are all things that are that don't have to do with the technology and the advancement of technology.
The hope that I have for a film like this, which I've been hoping for a long time, and I'm very glad to see it, is that it will make it more difficult, that it will cost them political capital to engage in the sort of crimes and abuses that we know and that we can see in a film like this are part of the drone wars. We've been speaking with Sonia Kennebec. The film is National Bird. The website is nationalbirdfilm.com. Opens in New York City on Armistice Day, in Los Angeles the next week, and elsewhere. Go find out more, get involved. Sonia Kennebec, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for it. It's a great discussion. I really appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, well, here we are. Much can and will and should be said about the, yes, presidential election of, yes, Donald Trump, including about media's role. On this first post-election show, we're going to focus on the question of what now? Not to say that how we got here is unimportant, it most certainly is, but to help us keep front and center that the purpose of reflection and criticism is to enhance our ability to actually change things. So, much to come, but for this week, what now? For electoral reform and congressional diversity, for the environment, for Muslim Americans and others made vulnerable by the so-called war on terror in its domestic and international fronts. We'll hear from Rob Ritchie and Cynthia Terrell from Fair Vote, from author and professor Deepa Kumar, from Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, and from Patty Lavera from Food and Water Watch. They're all coming up, but first, a brief look back at recent press. There are many lessons to be drawn from the 2016 presidential election about how one of the least discussed divisions in the country might be between the shocked and the unshocked, about the irreducibility of racism and misogyny and the connections between those things and economic disenfranchisement, about the gap between the electoral process and the will of the people, and about how folks may be less interested in messaging than in actual transformative policy. There's a lot to think about, but as we try to learn, we need to think about who we're learning from, because certainly one of the salient lessons of the election is that corporate media are not simply an inadequate vessel for a healthy democratic debate, but are in many ways an active impediment to it. You can start with the absence of substantive issues from elite media's election coverage, an analysis by FAIR's Benjamin Johnson looking at what made front-page election news in the New York Times, Washington Post, and USA Today found 47% of such stories to be mainly empty calorie stuff about who was gaining ground and who was broadening their outreach. Only 12% of stories were focused on actual policy issues. And though some of those were valuable, the idea that reporters should cover voter reaction to what major party candidates say rather than seeing what people are thinking about and putting those questions to candidates was unchallenged. Listeners have heard how little focus the corporate media debates provided to major areas of public concern like climate disruption, poverty, and police violence. And as for nightly news, analyst Andrew Tyndall reports that since the start of 2016, ABC, CBS, and NBC spent only 32 minutes of airtime on coverage of all substantive electoral issues. That's 32 minutes, and half of that was devoted to terrorism. Well, there may be mea culpas from media about how they should have listened more openly to angry white people. We suspect there will be few about how they should have front-burnered the suppression of black and brown voters through mass incarceration and the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. But what we certainly won't hear will be serious questions about corporate media's insular culture. Like why stardom goes to someone like Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen, whose post-election offering tried to show how both Republicans and Democrats ignore real issues in favor of retaliatory investigations, with the Democratic example being how, quote, they smeared Clarence Thomas, managing to turn a mediocre lawyer into a monumental martyr, close quote. To insult Donald Trump, Cohen says, quote, he has your average Nicaraguan army officer's grasp of our Constitution. He might order the return of torture, close quote. While Richard Cohen applauded the U.S. covert war on Nicaragua, inflicted because it overthrew a U.S.-backed dictatorship, and he supported pardons for its officers, in part because he used to see former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger at the supermarket, and he seemed like a nice guy. And for elite pundits like Richard Cohen, torture is, of course, something Nicaraguans do, though the latest Amnesty report doesn't cite that country, but does cite the United States. But then Cohen's on record saying CIA officers who torture shouldn't be prosecuted because, quote, it is imperative that our intelligence agents not have to fear that a sincere effort will result in their being hauled before some congressional committee or a grand jury. We want the finest people in these jobs, not time stampers who take no chances, close quote. Least of all should we look for media to ask about the impact of their ownership structure, how they make their money. But then they don't have to explain that. Their priorities were established early on when CBS CEO Les Moonves spoke to an industry group about the rise of the Donald Trump campaign.
Who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But, you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say.
You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. As we look forward from November 8th, it's clear there is work to do on many fronts. For many people, that work starts with electoral reform. We're joined now by Rob Ritchie. Rob Ritchie is executive director of the group Fair Vote. He's joining us from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Rob Ritchie, what now for electoral reforms?
I think the system is letting us down in how the candidates campaign, the choices voters have, the representation they ultimately get. And we are seeing, I think, real beacons of light in reform opportunities. And the one that I want to highlight is that Maine passed ranked choice voting, this great reform that we believe is one that should move quickly into other states. And that will be used in 2018 after winning handily in a referendum. And that's the kind of things that states can do. They can actually change their system to affect how we elect Congress. And that's what's happened in Maine.
What does that mean, ranked voting? How is that different?
So whenever we have more than two people run, there's this conundrum that is developed about can you vote for the person you like the most without the hazard of helping to elect the person you dislike the most? So is a third party going to be a spoiler? Is it going to split the vote? The problem is sort of a mathematical one, which is that if there's more than two people running, the votes can divide in such a way that the person with the most votes actually might not have majority support, but they just sort of finish top of the heap.
Right.
And so ranked choice voting is a vehicle to give voters more power that they're really typically ready to use, which is not only who do you like the most, but who would you really like to not see win and rank them last? In a partisan sense, you can say if you're dissatisfied with a major party as someone to really speak for what you care about, you can vote for someone who you think has a long shot to win but really speaks for your issues more, and that's your first choice. And you can say, but I do have a preference between the major party candidates and here's my second choice. And it's very liberating that way because you can then vote for whom you want, and this whole interscene repeating battle we see every cycle of like, oh, third party candidates shouldn't run, but oh, the major party candidates are disappointing. You know, like right. We don't have a system that allows us to handle that, and Maine now does.
Awful lot of folks nationally are looking at the Electoral College. What can you tell us about that or possibilities for change in that regard?
Right, because this is an election where Hillary Clinton is very likely to win the national popular vote by more than a million votes. So that's underscoring the fact that that doesn't govern the election. But what is always broken about the election is that they spend almost all their time in just these handful of states, to the point that four states drew more than half of all campaign events. So really it's the battle to be the president of the swing states of America. And they happen to be sort of the same swing states every cycle. So a proposal that's been moving in the states, another state-driven reform, is the National Popular Vote Plan, which is to say we'd like to have whoever wins the most votes in all 50 states and D.C. always win the presidential election. And so we're going to commit to give all of our states' electoral votes to that candidate in tandem with other states making that same commitment. 10 states in D.C. have already passed this, but not enough of them have passed it so that it represents a majority of the Electoral College yet. So they're currently at 165 electoral votes. So once it tops 270, then the number of states in the compact can then control the election, and all of their electoral votes will go to the national popular vote winner. And that's something that states can just keep on working on. There have been bills in all 50 states, and it's exciting that that change can happen. A lot of people have felt we need to change the Constitution to change the Electoral College, but you can actually use the Electoral College to achieve the objective of a national popular vote.
Cynthia Terrell directs the Representation 2020 Project at the group Fair Vote. She joins us now by phone. Cynthia Terrell, what now for diversity in Congress?
There's never been a successful tale to tell yet about diversity in Congress, which is one of those, I think, undertold stories about this election and so many other elections. There, of course, were a few great spots this last Tuesday, particularly for women of color in the Senate, in the House. There will be 9 new women of color who happen to all be Democrats in Congress, 3 in the U.S. Senate and 6 in the House. So that's terrific. But I think the overall picture and the overall climate for change is not very positive for women or for people of color, and that's something that we're going to have to address. I think one of the stark realities in terms of global representation, the United States ranks behind 95 countries in women's representation, and we just aren't increasing at nearly the same rate as other nations. And that, I think, should be a huge indicator to people who care about reflective representation to pay attention to what those other countries are doing and to think, wow, are there some systems approaches that we could be employing in the United States to correct that imbalance?
Well, the reason we're talking about this, of course, is that, Donald Trump has been elected president, and we think misogyny has a great deal to do with that, and we think that power has a lot to do with that, and it matters very much not just who is in the room, but who is in the room and able to say, you know, we will do this or not do that. And so the push then, I assume, of Representation 2020 is to encourage and to grow more women representation and gender parity in Congress.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, well, there really is only one country, Rwanda, frankly, which is above the parity line. Many countries, of course, have gotten much closer, countries in Latin America, countries in Europe. And a big part of that process has been being deliberate about the number of women candidates they were going to support and run and have on the ballot and had expected to win. And so I think we need to be more deliberate about that in the United States, and I think we need to do everything we can to address systems that disadvantage women candidates. There's quite a bit of academic study about the 30% threshold that in order for women to really be able to exert power and have influence in either a legislative body or a corporate body, for that matter, 30% is the minimum threshold for that. And so I think we need to do all that we can to ensure that both our state legislative bodies and our city councils and Congress itself at least get to that 30% threshold in the next few election cycles so that women can begin to exert more power and display that bipartisanship that women are well known for and the ability to listen carefully, to prepare for hearings. All those things that we hear seem to be true of women's leadership, and that's only going to happen, though, I think, if we're really deliberate about how we go about getting those women there.
Patty Lavera is Assistant Director at Food and Water Watch. She joins us by phone from D.C. Patty Lavera, what now for the environment and for environmental activism?
It's not good news, obviously. I think that's pretty, for folks that are interested in these issues, I think that's pretty clear. So, you know, in the very short term, we have work to do to figure out what exactly we're looking at, who are we looking at for running various agencies? And, you know, the early reports are pretty disturbing. The Trump administration seems very focused on going to the private sector, going to Wall Street. And, you know, he ran on a very openly anti-regulatory agenda. Mm-hmm. And so it's very clear that that's what we're going to be up against. So, you know, we have things to do in this lame duck Congress. it's been a very strange conversation about trade, you know, on both sides of the election, but we have to make sure nothing tricky happens, and we have to make sure that the TPP doesn't happen during the lame duck session, so that's a very immediate priority for us.
Right.
And then we're going to have to figure out what exactly we're looking at, but early in the new administration, we know they're going to be talking about wiping away regulations that are new or that were in progress. But I would say that one opportunity that we have to keep an eye on is this talk of infrastructure. You know, Trump is also talking about infrastructure. We have to make sure it's the right kind. It's that it's not just giving money to private entities to privatize water systems or things like that. Like, we have to make sure if there's going to be an investment in infrastructure, it's the right kind of investment.
And by make sure, do you mean with just oversight? Because what does it mean when you have anti-regulatory people in charge of regulatory agencies? What does that look like?
Well, we've seen this.
Yeah.
You know, we've lived through this with the Bush administration and other administrations. It means that the hand-to-hand combat of making regulations and what happens in Washington is going to get tougher, but we have to do it. So we're going to have to put pressure on folks who are actually, you know, on both sides of the aisle, who actually care about the outcomes, to be honest about what's going on. You know, we're going to need Democrats to be willing to stand up and try to block things where they can, especially in the Senate. We're going to have to do good analysis and point out the flaws in the way things are being packaged and sold and, you know, in cost-benefit analysis and stuff like that, and to call a spade when we see them trying to talk something up as an improvement and it's a cut. We're going to have to say so, you know, and we're going to have to be loud about it. And then the other thing I can't forget to mention is that Washington, D.C. is important. You know, we can't abandon it because things will get worse if we just walk away. But it's not the end-all, be-all. So I think we're going to see a lot of folks talking about, well, what can we do at the state level? What can we do at the local level? And I think it's time to make sure we have good coordination about that. You know, we can do stuff at the state level, and we absolutely should, but we can't abandon Washington if they can come in later and undo what you did at the state level. So we have to be coordinating that and paying attention to both. But I think especially on environmental issues, we're going to see a lot of, you know, creativity, and we're going to have to figure out what we can do elsewhere while preventing further damage in D.C.
We are joined now by Deepa Kumar. She's Associate Professor of Media Studies at Rutgers University, where she's Vice President of the Faculty Union, and author of, most recently, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Deepa Kumar, what now for Muslims and for anyone concerned with Islamophobia?
Yeah, this is a truly frightening time, Janine, for all people of color, certainly Muslim Americans as well. If it was not bad enough last year was 2015 will go down as having been the worst year for Muslim Americans in this country. Now, with a Trump presidency, that's just going to get worse because he has emboldened and enabled all of the far right wing racist white supremacist groups who, you know, like the KKK, which endorsed Donald Trump. He has emboldened them, and we're going to only unfortunately see more physical and verbal attacks. And it's not just the far right. I think that, you know, it has really awoken sort of latent racisms. You know, this country has a long history of racism, and those are going to come to the fore as well. I think, though, that once we get over our fear and shock of what's happened, we've really got to organize, and we've got to organize quickly. We just called a meeting tomorrow, an emergency meeting of my union. As you mentioned, I'm the vice president of the union. We are bringing together students and faculty to form a coalition on how to respond right now to what is happening. At our Newark campus, I heard a report that two Muslim American students were attacked. They filed a report with the campus police. But we need to build a wall of solidarity right now, which involves Muslim Americans, which involves African Americans, which involves white people, which involves anybody who does not believe that people should be targeted because of their ethnicity, religion, race, or gender for that matter. So that's how we're pushing forward, Janine, is yesterday we were stunned, today we organize.
And you have noted, Deepa, just finally, that we often tally up attacks, physical attacks on individuals, but Islamophobia takes other forms, and so there are other things that are more systematic that I suppose we can expect a worsening of as well.
Absolutely. I think that Donald Trump's promises that he is going to prevent Muslims from coming to this country by issuing a ban, that he's going to create a database where all Muslim Americans have to register, this is just horrendous. And I think that these structural factors are going to come into being in the months to come. But I do want to note, though, that as much as we should be scared of what Trump is going to do, this is not coming out of the blue. If you look at the dialogue and if you look at the discourse around the presidential elections, Clinton basically in her debates and in her discussions said, well, Muslim Americans are the eyes and ears of the national security state. What is she doing? She's just amplifying this idea that somehow the only value of Muslim Americans is to be agents of surveillance, and that if you're not, you're a bad Muslim, right? What this does, and what we've seen through the course of the Obama administration as well, is this idea that all Muslims somehow are culpable or responsible for the actions of a few. And unfortunately, when the Democrats cultivate this sort of attitude, the Republicans and the far right can take it one step, two steps, 100 steps forward. So this has been, I have argued, a bipartisan attack. And what we need is to organize at the grassroots level to fight back against this. And I think what this moment also allows for is solidarity with other racialized groups. After all, Trump has also gone after Mexicans. He's called them rapists. He's calling for a policy to have a national stop and frisk policy. This will affect African Americans. This will affect Mexican Americans and Latinos. And I think this is a moment where we have to come together around all of these issues, structurally as well as individually, to fight back for the kind of society we want to live in.
We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis. She's director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Phyllis Bennis, what now in terms of this country's foreign policy, defined as it is so much by the war on terror?
Well, you know, Janine, the big problem we face right now on the question of foreign policy is that we don't really have a clue what a Trump foreign policy will look like. We don't know who will be in charge. We do know that Trump does not have, either for himself or as connected to his party, what they call a deep bench in foreign policy, meaning obvious people who would be assigned to various jobs. The question has emerged, would he rely on corporate officials who negotiate international trade deals or international corporate deals? We simply don't know. We also don't know what Donald Trump stands for on foreign policy. He has said a number of things that people who have fought against wars and occupations for many years would look at and say, wow, that's not so bad. He's said, for example, that we should have better relations with Russia. He said once that the U.S. should be, quote, neutral between Israel and the Palestinians. He said we should say no to nation building, and he opposed the idea of a no-fly zone in Syria. But there's absolutely no reason to think that he's going to stick to those statements. He's made other statements completely opposed to them. Most notably, he said he would tear up the Iran nuclear deal. At various points, he called for nuclear weapons to be expanded to be available for Saudi Arabia and South Korea, and then disavowed those statements. I think that what we're dealing with here is a situation where he talks about his great slogan, making America great again, and the foreign policy and military part of making America great seems to be going back to an era of what he would consider unchallenged U.S. global hegemony. So it's less about creating a foreign policy that works, that protects people in the U.S. and makes us a good partner internationally. It's less about that than about a foreign policy that will ensure that the U.S. does not have a serious challenger. So I think what we're dealing with is a great deal of uncertainty. The only thing that we know for sure is that social movements are going to be far more important than anyone else. Social movements are going to be more important than who's in the Congress, who's in the White House, who's in the Supreme Court, because that's the only way we're going to have to change history. I think one of the things that we've seen very dangerous in the election process and in the coming Trump presidency is that the movement that rose up around his campaign has within it a really almost fascist core of racism, misogyny, xenophobia, Islamophobia. And this is very dangerous if that movement begins to feel that with Trump in the White House, they somehow have power and impunity from accountability, that they have legitimacy that they should never have had and never deserved, it will be even more dangerous. And so our social movements, I think many of us were already preparing for resisting what we anticipated would be a Clinton administration, saying no honeymoon, no waiting, mobilize immediately a movement against wars and escalation. We're still going to have to do that, but now we're going to have to do that, I think, in the context of a broader resistance movement where motions to work to build movements against wars is going to have to also be movements to defend refugees that are trying to come here as a result of those wars. And it's also going to have to link with movements who are providing the first defense for endangered communities, whether those be immigrant communities, refugees, people of color, Muslim communities, Arabs, women, LGBTQ communities. All of these communities could face serious dangers in the coming period because of that movement that has risen through the campaign process. And our movements to stop wars and create a foreign policy based on diplomacy over war is going to have to be part of those broader movements aimed at protecting those most vulnerable communities.
Thank you very much, Phyllis Bennis.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This program is a theoretical account of the worst-case scenario for global disaster. This is a real emergency.
America decided whether to elect a president who would go back to coal and rip up the Paris Climate Agreement. Meanwhile, the news from reality is not good. The United Nations Environment Program just released a report showing that even if all the promises made by almost 200 countries in the Paris deal are kept, and they're not being kept so far, the Earth still goes way past 2 degrees C in the safety limit, supposedly, soaring up to 3 degrees in the lifetimes of our younger listeners. That report, and all the Intergovernmental Panel reports before it, do not include large-scale climate drivers coming out of new science. In my show October 12th, Dr. James Curran from Scotland explained why plants are starting to capture and store less carbon dioxide. In this program, you'll hear startling new science showing that changes in the plant world alone can drive us into a new greenhouse world. That's a place where the animals we know, the bugs we know, and the crops we depend on may become extinct. Eventually, if we can't reverse the climate shift, humans may also disappear, as the dinosaurs once did.
We are living in an ice age. Mammoths would not, warm-blooded mammoths would have hardly been able to exist on the land if conditions were as warm as in the Cretaceous. Although there were some mammoths in the Cretaceous, mostly burrowing underground.
Meanwhile, in the Arctic, scientists are alarmed once again. The Arctic Ocean is much hotter than normal, with air temperatures up to 5 degrees hotter than they should be, even now, in what might be winter. The Arctic sea ice is not forming properly, and there is less of it than ever seen or measured before. Another record. It's another big red siren warning the world is tipping away into a new state. The world that mothered humans and all our companion species is changing away from us.
We have got to a very dangerous point. We're close to pushing the climate system beyond tipping points, which where the dynamics of the system can take over and become out of our control.
In the second half hour, we'll go to the place which is likely the first highly populated river delta to fall victim to rising seas. At least 3 to 5 million people will be driven out of one of the world's biggest food sources. And no, it's not Bangladesh. Stay with us for the journey. This is Radio EcoShock. We know that a changing climate is already affecting the plant world in many ways. There are changes in rainfall, drought, pests, and fires, just to name a few. But what we didn't know until now is that an altered plant world can increase the pace of climate change, leading to unpredictable outcomes. Isabel Montañez is from the UC Davis Department of Earth and Planetary Science. Dr. Montañez is a geologist, president-elect for the Geological Society of America, and helps edit a number of scientific journals. Isabel is the lead author of an important study published October 24, 2016, in the journal Nature Geoscience. A group of scientists managed to study an ancient time relevant to our own. Their results from hundreds of millions of years ago are not comforting. Isabel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Now, in the history of Earth's climate, what period did your international team of experts pick to research, and why?
So, as you know, we picked a time very far back, 300 million years ago, and most people would ask, why would anybody put much effort, or could they put much effort in a time so far back? And the answer is, for us in particular, that this is the last time that the Earth was in what we call a climate state of an ice house, a time when we have ice sheets at our polar regions. And these ice house times are, it turns out, are actually pretty rare in Earth history, and they're also very sensitive. They're sensitive to things like global warming. So we have developed over the past couple of decades a lot of expertise in this time period, this last ice house, and that's the primary reason that we focus there. But I think I'd like to say something about studying past times in general, because when one goes back to times that were well beyond when humans were roaming the Earth, we get a far bigger picture of what the climate system is capable of. And we are now in a condition where we haven't been in terms of our atmospheric CO2 for minimally 3.5-4 million years. And we could, within this century, get to a conditions of CO2 that we haven't seen for 34 million years. So we have to go back and look at deep times, we call them, or past times, to really get a sense for how things may go towards the future.
But we have no bubbles of air in the ice cores that far back. How did you manage to reconstruct the climate and the plant worlds for a period of 16 million years so very long ago?
Exactly. Well, that's true. And I see that you have had Bob Spicer on as a guest, and he's a great person to have had, I imagine. And as he's mentioned, we do use things like fossilized plants. We also use minerals that grew in ancient soils. And it turns out that the fossilized plants in particular, they have a high potential for being really well preserved. And some of the samples that we're looking at look like they came off the forest floor from a month or two ago. They're so incredibly well preserved. And what that means then is that we can use these tools that are very sensitive to atmospheric CO2, the amount of CO2 that is in that atmosphere. And so we do use that. We use plants. We use the chemistry of plants. And then when minerals form in soils, they are connected to the atmosphere through the processing of CO2 by plants. So we can use those as an independent a proxy, we call them, or monitor of what CO2 was doing in the past.
I find it amazing we have to go back around 300 million years to find a time when we had big ice caps at both of the poles. You called it an ice house world. Can you describe it a little for our listeners?
Yeah, so ice house worlds, and actually I'm going to step back and say that there are two types of climates that Earth has experienced since its very beginning, and those are greenhouse times when we just don't have ice on Earth. We might have little glacial mountain caps somewhere, but generally there are no big ice sheets. And those have actually been our more common climate state on Earth. And then we have these things called ice houses. Ice houses being times, usually times that are long-lived, millions of years, where we have big ice sheets at the poles. And we live in one of those right now. And that particular time began 34 million years ago. But the last time that was on Earth was when this period that we studied, 300 million years ago. And all the time in between has been a greenhouse. The thing about studying our more modern ice house is that the CO2 levels have been much, much lower. So if we want to look at a time where CO2 might be as high as we could get to in the next 50-100 years, then we have to go to that last ice house.
And the title of your paper talks about PCO2. What is that, and why use PCO2 instead of just CO2 for carbon dioxide?
So CO2 can be a liquid or a gas. And if it's a gas, we refer to it as pressure. And that's what that P is. It's partial pressure. So it's how much of the atmosphere do we feel as CO2 versus as oxygen or nitrogen.
Okay, let's get to the results of this paper. Isabel Montañez, what happened to the tropical forests around 300 million years ago?
I don't know that most people appreciate that all the coal on Earth, maybe 90% of that, formed from the burial of these tropical forests that were actually our first tropical forests that the Earth has witnessed. And these were these tropical forests 300 million years ago. They were incredibly expansive. They were all through the tropics and probably at times covered a third of the land that existed at that time. And so these forests turns out, quite sensitive to climate. And that is what initially triggers these changes. The climate warms. It tends to get drier throughout much of the tropics. They respond, and then it becomes sort of a domino or a cascading effect.
And how did the changes in tropical forests impact the atmosphere?
Plants harbor or sequester, we like to refer to, a lot of carbon. And they do that by their process of feeding and making plant matter, and that we call photosynthesis. So So plants absorb CO2. They have these breathing pores on their surface. And in fact, those breathing pores are really important because those are the ones that we can actually study to see how much CO2 there was in the atmosphere. So they take in CO2 and then they process it through photosynthesis and they make the cellular material. And typically that cellular material, once the plant dies, will rot or decay, and that carbon that was now sequestered in the plant is released back to the atmosphere. But if plant material can be preserved, maybe buried in swamps, in permafrost, and also in some wetlands, if it can be buried away, then we basically take that CO2 that was in the atmosphere and we hide it away for long periods of time. So in this particular time, these forests were capable of harboring or sequestering enormous amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. And everything was good until climate changes. And once they are disrupted, that process is disrupted, that CO2 ends up remaining in the atmosphere. And that leads to more climate change, and that's where the domino effect is triggered.
What drove that process where tropical forests flourished and then died back?
Presumably, there's something else in the background working to change CO2. We know that's always been the case in the past, and even when we look at the last million years, we can see that CO2 was going up and down with our times of more ice and times of less ice, it was going up. And we know that was a natural process. There weren't any humans to burn fossil fuels to increase CO2. And a large part of that is actually the forests doing it themselves. Whether there's an initial trigger, no doubt there is. And in part, those are other natural processes, like the change in the way that the Earth orbits around the sun and the tilt of the Earth's pole, rotating pole. Those all are natural things that change on a regular basis. But the real driver is essentially the changes in the plants themselves, once the trigger is set.
That's astounding. Well, while all this was happening, what about changes in sea level?
The thing about this study that was very interesting to us is that we started out actually with a goal in mind that isn't exactly what we came out with, and that goal was to better understand what plants can do to climate. We know from studying the more recent that they can have a huge impact on climate, but I'll leave that for a little later. But what we found in the process is that as the plants were changing, and when by changing, I should stress that what they're doing is they're migrating and they're dying out. So you can imagine a time where there's lots and lots of these tropical forests and they're very lush, and then the climate warms, dries out, and they die back, and they're replaced by, we call them opportunistic plants, sort of weedy plants, those that grow fast, but that don't sequester that CO2 as well, but that are really resilient and robust when it's dry. But they feed back on the climate differently. So we have these big changes going on, and we knew this was happening. It could happen. We wanted to understand then what it would do to feed back climate. But what we also learned was that sea level was changing dramatically. The regional climates were changing dramatically. And that's all part of the climate system's response. When it warms, ice melts back, and that melted water has to go somewhere, and it goes in the oceans, and sea level rises. And when the climate ameliorates and gets cooler, and the ice grows back, that water is taken out of the oceans and put into the ice sheets, and sea level goes down. And so what we see in this particular time period is these pretty large-scale sea level changes. We're talking tens of meters of change with these CO2 changes of 200 parts per million or so during times of peak versus minimum ice. And the important thing, I think, is that these changes in CO2 are all within the range that we anticipate with business as usual from fossil fuel burning. So it really does say that sea level can rise more than a meter in response to a doubling in CO2.
Radio EcoShock.
Which proves that for pure chilling horror, nothing can beat cold, hard facts.
From the University of California, Davis, we're speaking with geologist Dr. Isabel Montañez. She's led a team which uncovered unsettling news about the ways deforestation can lead to destabilization of our climate. Your research covered millions of years. That's a very long time. Isabel, did you find signs of a climate shift at a pace anything like humans could be creating now?
So there's no question that the natural swings we see in this study are certainly within the range of what humans and fossil fuel burning, deforestation, could do in our future. That's depending on what scenarios we follow in our future. But if we do business as usual and we look at burning through at least most of their fossil fuel reserves and resources, then absolutely we're looking at CO2 that could go well over 550, 600 parts per million. Left unabated, it could be 1,000 parts per million. And the changes we saw are even less than that. They're within the range of 200 to 500-600 parts per million. So, but the key thing that all these studies have revealed is that in the past, when we study times of climate change, including the one that we did, we see things happening at least an order, if not in this case, probably two orders of magnitude slower rates than what has been happening in the last 100 years and what presumably will continue at a fairly similar rate until we have a very different scenario. So yes, it is relevant in terms of process. It's relevant in terms of documenting the magnitude of change, climate change that can happen, sea level change that can happen, but it also, once again, reveals a message that is how fast humans are altering our Earth in comparison to our natural past.
And you mentioned upper limits, and I noticed looking through your past papers, one asks, was atmospheric CO2 capped at 1,000 ppm over the past 300 million years? Was it?
Well, so over the last 300 million years, no. We know that it has crept over 1,000. It's probably even approached 2,000 when dinosaurs roamed the Earth, for instance. And certainly 55 million years ago when there was a lot of CO2 released to the atmosphere fairly rapidly, more rapidly than in this study's case, it crept up further. You know, about 2,000 is probably reasonable. But in the ice house times, for CO2 to go very high is unusual because ice is just not stable. And in fact, that's what our study shows, is that ice can change, can melt back dramatically when CO2 creeps up over 400, 500, 600 parts per million.
And as I said in the introduction, forests in many parts of the world are already in trouble. It isn't all climate change, of course. We have massive logging for wood and paper. Forests are cleared for agriculture and cities. Does it matter what causes the destruction of tropical forests for this climate feedback to start operating?
Right. So, I want to take the opportunity here. I actually really like this question. Take this opportunity to actually, if it's okay, to kind of give a two-part answer. The one directly to your question, it's interesting. I think most scientists didn't think it really mattered, but there was a study that came out maybe a month or two ago that really pointed out how it does matter. And it comes down to the interconnection of things. I mean, that's the Earth system, right? That it's everything is interconnected. And what this study of the Amazon basin showed is that it's not just about the deforestation area itself, but it's the interplay with those areas adjacent to it. Are there small villages? Are there larger semi-urban areas being encroaching on those? Are there river systems? How are those polluted or not? How has the deforestation been done? And so it turns out, apparently, it actually is very important how it's done, both in terms of space and in approach.
And from what you've seen in the record of the ancient past, can we guess how much tropical forests need to diminish before this big climate feedback kicks in?
Right. So this is where I'm going to mention there's actually another climate feedback, and that's probably even more important. And it is one that we initially were chasing with our study, and we did find exactly what we anticipated. Oh, I shouldn't say exactly what we anticipated. We certainly found that it's an important feedback. And that is that most people don't appreciate that the forests of the world today cycle about twice a year all the water vapor in the atmosphere. That's a huge amount of water movement, and with that, heat energy, and it makes a, it impacts our climates, especially our regional climates, tremendously. And what our study showed, as others are starting to show, is that because plants can't migrate, they can't move like animals can, not as fast, they have an ability to change their functioning, the way that they move water through their leaves, the rate at which they feed effectively or photosynthesize. And in the in doing so, they change the water cycle. They change the CO2 in the atmosphere. And we call this ability to adapt plasticity. It's literally an ability to be flexible. But what we didn't appreciate, because studying modern plants and the recent past, there hasn't been that much climate change to really see the difference. But what we've learned in our study, I think a few others are coming out with similar things, is that this plasticity can be huge. And it means that these plants, like our, in our case, these really lush, robust tropical forest plants were able to move lots of water, cool the planet, take up the CO2 and sequester it. But when the opportunists moved in, they don't do it as well. And they are drought tolerant, so they close down their water transfer. They don't photosynthesize as efficiently. And so now that water has to go somewhere, and it means we have more drought or locally dry, probably more seasonal climates. It means we have more runoff into streams, into the ocean, which is not a good thing in that it can cause bacterial blooms, things like this. So these feedbacks, they're pretty complex, but they have an enormous impact on what plants can do. And for our current forests, we don't know the answer because we haven't really modeled them effectively. We don't know what these feedbacks will do in terms of then setting off more climate change and maybe setting off further impact on the ecosystems. And so we can't really answer how much of the forests can we lose before we set off this trigger, this sort of domino effect.
This is new research. I presume previous reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change did not include such a large-scale feedback from plants, and that probably means any carbon budgets and predictive pathways are underestimated. They will need to be adjusted. Would you agree?
Absolutely. They have not, and that's because the models themselves, the climate models that are used by the IPCC to try to project future climate, haven't yet been able to incorporate these kinds of feedbacks. There are a few that started and that are referred to in that latest report that came out a couple years ago, but it'll be the next report that I think we'll start to see some of the more sophisticated feedbacks that are included in there, and I think we'll see that they'll make big differences.
On a personal level, I fear nature will take over from human drivers in a wrenching shift in the climate, and at that point, we couldn't stop the big change. Isabel Montañez, do you worry about that, and are we already there?
So those are, things that we call thresholds, and there are many different climate thresholds on Earth. We probably have crossed one. I think most climate scientists will agree that the sea ice up in the Arctic, the loss of summer sea ice, perhaps permanently, that's one that we probably have crossed. We probably haven't crossed many others. The people keep an eye on Greenland ice sheet. Will that collapse? If we continue on business as usual, there's no doubt we're going to cross thresholds. And as we cross thresholds, we typically create new feedbacks, these domino effects, which just then amplifies things. Do I think we'll go there? I think I still have hope in humanity and perhaps in particular in technology. I think we certainly have the technology coming on board to artificially sequester CO2, take it out of the atmosphere. It just hasn't started. It's expensive. But I think we're starting to finally get the attention of the world in general and Americans in particular, and I think we won't stay on the business as usual for certainly not hopefully through this entire century.
Isabel, what can we do with this new science about plant feedbacks now that we know?
Well, I think scientists knew that they certainly appreciated this plasticity in plants for about two decades now. They've been studying short-term effects, and what is really important, I think one of the main messages from our study is how those have to be incorporated in these new generation models. It's challenging. It requires many, many, many thousands of lines of code, probably tens of thousands, because it's very dynamic to model. But I think that's probably one of the most important lessons here, is that we can't ignore just how big the role of our plants on the land are in terms of setting our climates and our CO2 levels.
We humans do have a limited time to reconstruct what we need to know. Should we just continue to recover the whole past history of life on Earth, or do we need to focus on times that matter to our predicament now?
And that is the million-dollar question that scientists and funding agencies have been discussing at workshops and such, because, of course, there's not enough time and there's not enough money. And the answer is, it's difficult to come down to a yes or no. I think I'd like to really reiterate and stress that we are already at a climate state that we haven't observed for 3.5 million years. And almost certainly we're going to go to one within the next several decades by the end of the century that will be somewhere between that 3.5 million year period and potentially as far back as 34 million years ago. And what we have learned in studying the past, including many other different time periods, is just how diverse Earth's climate system is. And what we've learned from studying the more recent, and I even mean the last maybe 100,000 years, is that it is such a small window of climate's potential for change and how ecosystems respond and regional climates respond. So we have to look at the past, the deep past, to really understand the full range. And that's the only way we're really going to understand what is a potential climate of our future in this evolving CO2 environment we're creating.
Is there anything I've missed you'd like to tell our listeners?
No, I think we've covered most. I thought it was interesting. You did mention to me earlier in a question that what does it feel like to tramp back in the deep past, and I thought I'd comment that we're all forensic scientists, those of us studying the deep past climate, and it's just phenomenal to be able, because these are nature's natural experiments that we can tease out by chemical means and physical means, biological means, and it reveals wonderful secrets of the past, including just how robust the climate system is and how really a phenomenal interconnected system it is. So I suppose the message of that is just how important it is to take care of that and sustain that system.
We've been talking with Isabel Montañez. She's a Chancellor's Leadership Professor with the UC Davis Department of Earth and Planetary Science. Isabel is also the lead author of the paper Climate, PCO2, and Terrestrial Carbon Cycle Linkages During the Late Paleozoic Glacial Interglacial Cycles. It's a bit of a mouthful. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on October 24, 2016. You can find links to that paper, Isabel's work, and our discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Isabel, thank you for sharing your time and insight. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Gradually it would dawn on people that the world has changed and it isn't going to go back to the way it was before. Some people emotionally could never make the transition to accepting this change. They would continue to hope that their previous lives would be restored, but of course they never would be.
Unless you are one of the 17 million people living there, you probably don't know much about the Mekong Delta. Maybe you have images of the Vietnam War, but that was in another century. Rice comes pouring out of the Mekong Delta, exported all over the world, but that delta is due to become the world's preview of highly populated lands disappearing under rising seas. David Brown is a retired American diplomat and experienced Vietnam expert. He's lived and taught there. David just released a stunning four-part series on the perils of the Delta. It's published at the popular online site Manga Bay. We've reached David at his home in Fresno, California. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, why should we care what happens where the Mekong River meets the sea?
Well, I think you've hinted at it already, Alex, that this is, in a sense, a preview or a dry run for what could happen in a lot of places in the world. Back in 2007, the World Bank released a report where it called the Mekong Delta, along with the Nile Delta and then the Delta in Bangladesh, the Ganges, one of the most vulnerable places in the world to climate change. And that, of course, got the Vietnamese caught their interest. But it's really not until now that they're seriously coming to grips with the implications, the scope and the intensity of the changes that climate change, as well as alterations of the river flow from dam building upstream and from some of their own hydrological engineering in the Delta area, how all of this is combined to create a problem that needs now to be adjusted, find a new strategy that deals with sea level rise, salt infiltration, changing monsoon rain patterns, and alterations to the river flow. So what we've got here is a laboratory that's probably relevant to what we're going to face and we Americans are going to face in South Florida or on the Carolina coast, in the inland delta of California, and other low-lying places.
Let's get oriented. Where does the Mekong River start, run, and who are the countries involved in using its waters?
Sure. The Mekong is the 11th longest river in the world, 2,700 miles. It rises in the Tibetan Plateau. It flows very rapidly through deep canyons in Yunnan in China, southern China, and then comes down into lower elevations in Laos, Burma, and ultimately Cambodia, and then reaches the South China Sea in the southern part of Vietnam. Comparing it to the Mississippi River system, there's a couple of interesting things here. The average annual discharge of both rivers is approximately equal, but the Mekong watershed is only about a quarter of that of the Mississippi-Missouri system. And there's a huge annual variation in flood according to the seasons. At the height of the annual flood pulse, that's in September, it's about 18 times the flow at the driest point in March and April. So it's hydrologically, it's a remarkable river. Actually, because of the variation and because of the way that every year a lot of the river's flows into the Great Lake in Cambodia, which functions as a huge aquifer and also something that levels out the seasonal flow and prolongs the floods the time when the crops are in.
And you've been to the Mekong Delta this year, interviewing a lot of people. I was impressed by that. So if we were to go there, just on the Delta, is it all flat grassy lands, or what does it look like?
Well, first, imagine an area about the size of Switzerland, but obviously flat instead of mountainous. Very green in most times of the year in most parts. Very highly engineered. There's a network of dikes and sluices and canals and so forth that's been developed intensively over the last century or so, which controls flooding and directs the water this way and that way. The soils of the Delta are mainly rich and alluvial. They were laid down over the last 6,000 years. But it's in no way can be called a natural environment anymore, but rather an engineered environment. And one in particular has been tuned to produce just about as much rice as possible.
I've seen those bags of rice from Vietnam in local grocery stores, so I know that it's going out all over the world. Now, we will talk about the mega hydro dams that you mentioned and the diversions that threaten the river, but I do want to start with climate threats. You wrote that no delta area, not the mouths of the Ganges, the Nile, or the Mississippi, is more vulnerable than the Mekong estuary to the predictable impacts of climate change. And I found that hard to believe. I always thought it would be in Bangladesh. So this comes as a bit of a surprise to me and perhaps to our listeners. Why is the Mekong the most vulnerable?
Like Bangladesh, the Mekong Delta is heavily populated. About a quarter of Vietnam's total population of 90 million. And the mean elevation above what used to be normal sea level is less than 2 meters. Roughly a third of the delta has an elevation of 1 meter or less. But the biggest vulnerability, from my perspective, is the impact of the decisions made about engineering over the last century or so to control the water. Essentially, particularly since 1975, Vietnam has, as I said, tried to get the maximum amount of rice that can be produced. They have had a kind of a food security, which I call it, almost a neurosis. And food security policy was implemented, perhaps over-implemented, but the decision was to maximize the cropping of so-called miracle rice, which requires that the water level be very strictly controlled. To do that, they had to build dikes which essentially defeated the annual flood pulse of fresh water coming down the river and instead enabled them to precisely control the amount of rice which got to the paddy at all times of the year. This enabled triple cropping of rice. It enabled Vietnam to produce rice in the order of 25 million tons per year in the last decade or so, of which 8 million tons is exported. But the consequences are very tough on the land itself. They haven't been getting the nutrients that flooding would bring. And a lot of that fresh water that comes down the river goes straight out to sea instead of spreading over the delta and replenishing its own aquifers. So a lot of the discussion on how to build in more resilience to climate change and to mitigate its impact revolves around undoing some of these water control decisions and returning the delta to a more natural state, to emphasizing a much more diverse mixture of crops and vegetables, and in a sense, living with the floods, but getting the benefits. That would enable, among other things, for farmers to spend a lot less money on pesticides and fertilizers if they get the benefit of soap from upriver, as used to be the case. So as I tried to describe in my articles, it's a pretty complicated question. And when in building a consensus among stakeholders on what's the appropriate way to go has been a bit of a challenge.
Well, now, looking at a map, the capital of Vietnam, Hanoi, is at the north end of the country, while the Mekong is in the deep south of Vietnam. Do those divisions and maybe cultural differences continue long after the war, and does that affect how policy might be implemented when we face these challenges?
Well, there are important cultural differences, but I would say that the biggest problems as far as deciding and implementing policy fall into two baskets. One, the country is run by a fairly small elite, the Vietnamese Communist Party, which is secretive. Its decision-making is not transparent. There's been some emphasis on trying to consult more broadly and more openly, but it's pretty slow progress. So that in itself is a problem. There's just not the kind of civil society participation in working through any national issues, not just what to do about climate change in the Delta. The second big challenge from a political machinery perspective is that although, in many respects, Vietnam's a totalitarian state, and there are lots of examples where Hanoi has said, this is what's going to happen. And the follow-through at the province or district level is negligible because they're asking for something that the local officials just don't believe in or or don't see how that's going to help them.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with our guest David Brown about the Mekong River Delta in Vietnam. Nonprofit groups have warned us that there are problems there, and now we have an excellent article from David about it. You know, occasionally I talk with Indian scientists about climate change, and their preoccupation is the monsoons and then the monsoons. Will a warming world alter these life-giving rains in Vietnam as well?
Alex, it's already evident. I was actually quite impressed by what I heard from scientists in Vietnam when I was there in June, that there's now a fairly consistent pattern with the monsoons are arriving several weeks later than had been the normal pattern. And while there's about as much rain as before, it tends to be a little bit bunchier in September and October, and that itself is a kind of a shock to the equilibrium of the hydrological management.
Okay, well, let's move on to the dams now, and it's a huge subject. I was reading through your article, and my head almost spins just looking at the various proposals and the size of them. What sort of dams have already been constructed on the Mekong?
Well, none up until now in the lower or central Mekong. Upstream in China, in those canyons I mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of dam building. And the Chinese are good at dam building, and they emphasize it. And so they're very keen to export their technology farther down the river. They've got a willing disciple in the Lao government, which is absolutely charmed by the notion of producing enough electricity to become, quote, the battery of Southeast Asia, meaning basically exporting a lot of electricity to Thailand and Malaysia. And so ultimately, over the protests of the Cambodians, as well as the Vietnamese, some years back, the Lao green-lighted the first of a total of seven dams proposed for the Mekong mainstream in Laos. Now, the location is important because about 60% of all the water that arrives in Vietnam is added to the river from rivers in the area of Laos and Burma. And there's already a lot of damming of the tributaries. That's not such a thing, or near as big a problem as the possibility that the annual rainfall could be impounded and then only slowly released by a series of dams along the mainstream of the river. Incidentally, two more dams were proposed in Cambodia. The Cambodians seem to have decided that that's not, that's off the drawing board for them.
So part of the problem you've just mentioned is the fact that instead of an annual flood, which the Vietnamese have learned to control and use, they would just get sort of a steady dribble from these dams. But what about the whole problem of silt and replenishing the soils as well?
Okay. Already, the amount of silt that's reaching the Mekong Delta is about half of the historical average. And that's a huge change. Okay. I was talking to a friend, a newspaper reporter in Can Tho, the biggest city in the Delta, and he said the story that he'd written, he tries to write stories that will communicate with ordinary people. He said the one that got the most reaction was one which featured pictures of the river flowing clear blue instead of murky brown in June. And it's not supposed to happen. The river is supposed to be full of silt. So this was a kind of a striking paradox. And my friend said that's, according to fishermen he's talked to, that's pretty much the way things have become. Most of the attention that's been given to the dams on the Mekong has been the predictable impact on the world's most prolific inland fisheries by interfering with fish migration, and that's a very big concern also. But for the Vietnamese, the real problem is the change in the overall volume of water, the pattern of its arrival in the Delta, and the fact that it's not going to be carrying anything like the amount of silt and other nutrients that used to be normal.
Who would finance these mega dams, David Brown? Is the World Bank involved?
That, of course, was pretty common in the old days, but the multinational banks have pretty much gotten away entirely from financing large dams like this, as understanding of the side effects, the potential adverse consequences of these big dams is more broadly understood. So if the dams are built, financing is going to have to come almost entirely, I think, from Chinese banks through the new through China's new Asian Infrastructure Bank. And there's some speculation now that probably all the ones that are projected will not be built because of the difficulty of trying to predict what the markets for electricity will be like in 15 or 20 years from now.
And then, incredibly, Thailand has announced plans to divert water out of the Mekong River. What do the Thais want to do, and is it correct that they've already tried it a little bit?
They've experimented this summer with a kind of a scale model of a rather ambitious plan to pipe water from the Mekong, or actually from the mouth of a very small tributary of the Mekong, through the mountains and into the basins of a couple of rivers in Thailand's northeast area, which is typically fairly arid, potentially diverting a fairly large fraction of the river's flow. And I'm not persuaded they're going to go through with this plan. It may have just been, if you will, talk from the government in response to the fact that Thailand, like Vietnam last winter, was experiencing the worst drought in many, many years, in Vietnam 90 years, and the government needed to be seen to be doing something.
Yes, that drought, I did read about that. Now, Lester Brown was the founder of both World Watch and the Earth Policy Institute, and he often warned that rice was already near or at the top of its temperature tolerance. And I've seen other studies suggesting if the global mean temperatures go up a degree, rice production goes down by at least 10%. What have you heard about this?
You're right that rice doesn't tolerate increased temperatures all that well. No crop does. Although I haven't seen numbers as apocalyptic as the ones you mentioned. But there's something else at work here, and that's the fact that through breeding it's possible to, over time, to both come up with varieties of rice which have more tolerance to salt infiltration, and potentially also can withstand, have strains that can withstand higher temperatures. All of this without any genetic modification whatsoever, but simply breeding experiments at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is David Brown, a retired American diplomat who then became an educator in Vietnam. His latest article at mongabay.com warns us about a developing climate disaster in the Mekong River Delta. David, the scientists I talk with are pretty certain we will get at least 1 meter of sea level rise globally by the end of this century. Of course, it will vary in certain parts of the world. Your article in Monga Bay suggests that could force the migration of between 3 and 5 million people out of the Mekong Delta. Can Vietnam cope?
Okay, a change in the population of the Delta on that scope actually is not would not be such a horrible thing. Every country in the world, as it develops, has produced more and more farm crops with fewer and fewer people, while others move into services and industry and so forth. And that's been happening in Vietnam since the 1990s, when the Vietnamese gave up on doctrinaire socialism and adopted a essentially capitalist economy. So there's been a fair amount of migration from the Delta already to the industrial zones around Ho Chi Minh City, what used to be Saigon. And the farmers have become more efficient. Buffalo have been replaced by small tractors, and a lot of the heavy labor that people used to have to do has now also been mechanized, so that extra labor is really only needed in the harvest season. And in fact, there's a lot of people who don't have land, who are just sort of scraping through, who might find better opportunities elsewhere.
Interesting. Okay. Well, now the government of Vietnam must be making plans to deal with the impacts of climate change. What have you heard about that?
I think we can say that the government, certainly the stakeholders, are talking about what can be done in a serious way. A few years ago, the ministries of agriculture and of the environment and natural resources began some very serious discussions with the facilitation of the Dutch. And the Dutch have had a very active, rather effective development assistance program in Vietnam for some time. And, of course, they do know something about managing delta areas and holding back the sea. Well, it's been a fairly, quite a productive exercise as far as first bringing together two ministries which are usually trading insults and getting them to work cooperatively. And secondly, once a general plan was worked out, vetting this with stakeholders, including farmers, including agro-industry, and, of course, the folks in the universities and who know something about the changes in store for the Delta. And after a lot of discussion, it was now, I guess, 2013 that this plan was presented to the government. That was December of 2013. But time passed, and there was a political change at the top. It's only now, according to my friends, that the government seems to be actively discussing what can and ought to be done. And there's an expectation that there will be a kind of a first hearing of what is proposed by the National Assembly in its session, which starts at the end of this month. Shall I talk, Alex, about the contents of the Mekong Delta Plan, which the government is considering?
I would like to hear it, yes.
Okay. Essentially, you recall there's been a big problem with salt infiltration. And last year, it was going inland up to 100 kilometers, halfway across the Delta. Now, this was certainly a wake-up call for a lot of folks. And to me, it certainly made the notion of a slow strategic retreat kind of sound very sensible. The idea is that instead of trying to grow rice and other crops which require fresh water in the coastal areas, they'll be allowed to become brackish, essentially given over to shrimp aquaculture and other activities which make good use of salty water. And in efforts to increase the retention of fresh water in natural aquifers farther up the river, diversifying crops, breeding, as I mentioned earlier, for salt tolerance, and generally adjusting to or adapting to climate change rather than trying to resist it by building dam after dam. Now, for that to happen requires basically a big change in orientation by the Ministry of Agriculture, and it's not yet entirely clear to me that they're on board. But I think one of the most important reasons why the rest of the world ought to keep an eye on Vietnam is to find out how, when you get down to questions which involve social change, really well-thought-out, no-regrets, economic planning and other things, is whether a government, almost any government, is able to, in fact, exercise this kind of experiment in long-range planning, in the full knowledge that whatever is done is only going to slow down and delay the inevitable. There's, to my understanding, scientists expect that sea level rise is not going to stop at 1 meter, although it may reach there by 2100. But, you know, it's clear that in Vietnam and other places, the notion of planning, adaptive planning, is going to have to go on a rolling basis. And as the Dutch experts emphasized, trying to avoid doing stupid stuff, not investing a lot in plans which are bound only to maybe only delay the inevitable, but in fact, truly adapting.
In that way, Vietnam is almost like a workshop for the world, and it's so unfair because the people of Vietnam have contributed so little to the atmospheric pollution. I mean, we are the people who have polluted the atmosphere, but they're the people who are going to have to adapt and then keep on adapting for centuries. As we finish up, I get the feeling that Vietnam is almost like your second home, like an adopted relative. How did you get there, David, and why does it continue to matter to you?
Well, you know, I finished college in 1964, Alec, and joined the American Foreign Service. I was very young, very idealistic. I was sent out to work at the embassy in Vietnam. Spent a lot of time going around and trying to find out what people were thinking and write coherent reports about that. But I arrived in Vietnam an idealist, and like many others of my generation, I went home a cynic. But I never lost my fascination for the country and the charm and the beauty. Its charm, its beauty, its wonderful food. There's a great deal to like about Vietnam. And so when I had an opportunity after my retirement from the State Department to lead up an environmental education project in Ha Lam Bay in North Vietnam, working with kids, local high school, college kids, in helping them to understand how man's activities, both tourism on the bay and industrial development on its margins, were gradually killing it, its economic value. Well, I jumped at the opportunity to do that. Did that for 3 years, spent another couple of years in Hanoi, and it reached the point in my ability to read and understand Vietnamese that it was kind of a natural that when my wife and I returned to the U.S. To basically put down our roots again, that I began to write about it.
We've been talking with David Brown. He's retired from the American Diplomatic Service. He's lived and taught in Hanoi, as you've heard, and doing environmental education as well. His work has been published by most of the major journals and periodicals covering East Asia. It's a long list. And I'm recommending his four-part illustrated article on the Mekong Delta. The first of those was published October 3rd, 2016, with the title, Will Climate Change Sink the Mekong Delta? Find that at mongabay.com or look for all the links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for talking with us, David.
Alex, it's been my pleasure indeed.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Now you know, the next step is to dedicate yourself, as I do, to convincing our fellow humans we have to act to save the climate. We do it for ourselves, for billions of people who just want decent lives, for our kids and descendants. We do it for all the innocent creatures whose cycles and lives will be destroyed in the whirlwind of climate shift. We do it because, as the coming years and decades will reveal, there is no other choice. My thanks to everyone who keeps this program going. Thank you to the scientists, authors, and activists who share their time with us. They do it for free. And thank you for listening and caring about our world. Here's 2525, done by Venice Beat and featuring Tess Timothy.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Hundreds of student activists are going to be converging in Fairfax, Virginia for the 2016 National Students for Justice in Palestine Conference. The theme will be critical mass with our roots in resistance, forging a just future. National SJP says in a statement, quote, our student Palestine solidarity movement is at a pivotal point. Confronted with forms of repression, both old and new, we must draw on our history of grassroots organizing to develop ways of effectively and proactively responding to this backlash while channeling our remarkable energy and focus towards our ultimate goal of liberation for Palestine and all oppressed peoples. Joining us to talk about why students are converging and what this pivotal point in student activism looks like are two members of National Students for Justice in Palestine, Samer Al-Saleh from UC Santa Cruz and Malcolm Lazzappi of Stanford University. Samer and Malcolm, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the conference. Reading through some of the materials on nationalsjp.org, there's a lot of emphasis on, of course, building more divestment campaigns, but also pushing beyond divestment. Summer, can you talk about your work at UC Santa Cruz and what that means to you, especially since your university has already passed a student divestment resolution? What's next?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of UC Santa Cruz's RSJP is currently in a space that a lot of other SJPs, especially on the West Coast, are at, where we've passed divestment and we're not quite sure where to go from there. I think that part of what we want to work on this year is kind of we're in a weird space where we're trying to figure out what is next. Part of what we want to do is to actually pressure the university to materially divest from the corporations that profit off of the occupation. But I think we also do want to move beyond BDS in the sense that we want to push forth on our campus more of an anti-Zionist politics where we aren't constantly having to push against or respond to Zionist organizations, but where we actually are sort of like have the ideological power on our campus, where instead of us having to defend ourselves against university and the oppression, where we are able to instead kind of have a base of support, if that makes sense.
So as far as like what we're doing right now, we're doing a lot of education. We sort of fell to like deaf ears, like no one responded to our calls for divestment. We sent letters to the president, the board of directors. They kind of responded with it's too divisive to talk about. So we're not even going to look into whether there are human rights abuses. So really, it looks like building power, like student to student, and like internal education. So we're holding like cultural events. We're like bringing in speakers and we're really trying to build a base. Since divestment happened, like that was 2 years ago. And like a lot of people have graduated or are now moving into different parts of their lives. So we have to like build that up and then move forward. But you were asking about how NSJP is trying to like mobilize alongside and beyond divestment. Since we're like folks are hitting roadblocks at their schools, what are ways that we're going to try to combat this? And I think one of the most powerful things that this NSJP conference is going to have for the first time is actually a non-conference space. You know, like each year we ask SJPs and SJP members, SJPers, what sort of like workshops they want to see, who they want to talk to, what sort of things they want discussed in panels. discussions and presentations, what kind of skills they want to build. But at this conference, we're starting an unconference space, which is basically a space that, you know, people come together and they decide what they're going to talk about at the conference. And that way, I think it's really, like, I think we're bringing in an organic element that allows folks to speak specifically onto what they're struggling with, and then also speak with people who are specifically dealing with those things too. And I think that's really going to help with brainstorming and, like, moving beyond what we've currently been doing.
National SJP has said that students are now mobilizing, trying to strategize against what they call repression in forms both old and new. Can you talk a little bit about how students are mobilizing and especially what might be coming up at this conference, some maybe new strategies, new tactics that students are talking about?
Yeah. So when I think about like fighting repression on our campuses, particularly like the new forms of repression that exist, like I think this looks like building like across movements. So often what like the success of Zionist repression on our campuses, like from outside groups or from the administration, what it often looks like is like the isolation of our groups, where we're stigmatized and like racialized and criminalized, and where they attempt to like set us apart and isolate us from like any other form struggles. And I think that what SJPs have been doing really well is like linking up with other struggles, like other people struggling on their campuses, as well as like not just on our campuses, but like also like, you know, SJPs doing stuff with the like Dakota Access Pipeline, like supporting what's going on there. And so I think often what fighting repression looks like is by kind of refusing this isolation that is constantly like forced onto us in a way. Given the political climate where we are like stigmatized on campuses, and like this, I think this sort of ranges, and it's like not something that we can just like apply to every campus. Like at UC Santa Cruz, I think it's a lot less extreme than it might be on other campuses. But like, despite whatever the level of like a stigmatization, it like often makes it really difficult for us to organize. And I think that, I don't know what we're thinking about, and I think what other SJPs are thinking about is like how to tactically think about sort of like shifting this political climate and taking advantage of sort of like shifting ways of, then the ways that like Palestine has made its way into like mainstream discourse, and sort of like using that as a way to like push our own narrative to the forefront, where, like I said, like where we're not having to constantly legitimize or humanize ourselves, but where it's like almost a given, where it's common sense, and rather like the opposite side, like the people who are supporting like the genocide of Palestinians, like who are supporting the Israeli apartheid state, are the groups that are having to legitimize what they're saying, where we're not constantly put on blast and having to do that work. And I think that comes through, it's not an overnight thing that happens, like a process that will happen through like ongoing like political action and political education and whatnot.
Malcolm, why should students get involved in SJP, and why is it a critical time right now to be an SJP member?
I think it's always been a critical time to be an SJP member, especially like there's SJPs everywhere, but especially in the US, given our government's sustained contribution to the Israeli state, I forget what the actual name of the payment is, but we send billions of dollars every year. I think it's important to recognize that and joining SJP, like, is a way of saying, you know, actually, we don't support this, but also building outside of that framework of, oh, this is what our government does, and recognizing that we all have a level of complicity with regard to the nation state of Israel.
And Summer, finally, what are you most looking forward to at the national conference? What do you hope comes out of it?
I'm most looking forward to, I'm new to the national organization, and I'm sort of becoming familiarized with the way it functions. Prior to like my involvement, I didn't really know like the work that NSJP did. So I guess like what I'm looking forward to is like continuing to build a structure within NSJP. Last year at the conference, they came up with a structure, which is like the representatives from each, from the West Coast, you know, South, East Coast, and Midwest. I'm really looking forward to sitting down with people and figuring out like what this means, what it means to have elected representatives in NSJP, and how we can like further build our structure so that we can effectively help other SJPs who are in different places politically on their campuses.
I also wanted to add to Summer's excitement about building with the coordinating committee and this new national structure that we have that we approved in San Diego. I know folks have been saying this is a long time coming, and I think it'll yield itself to a particular type of national conversation that is, I wouldn't say just representative, but also more grassroots, because we're bringing in more people and we're specifically looking at each region and trying to bring like tie them in a very concrete way. So I think that'll yield to some very powerful stuff to look forward to.
Well, we are looking forward to seeing what comes out of the conference as well, and of course the work that SJP chapters and its members do on a daily basis across the country. So thank you so much for being with us. Those are the voices of Summer El Saleh from UC Santa Cruz and Malcolm Lazzappi of Stanford University. Summer and Malcolm, thank you so much. And
thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Noah.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
I think we have Zafar Bengash on the line. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
I made you wait a bit so that I could do commercial with you and for you.
That's fine.
For,
that's absolutely fine.
A commercial for us, yes. Using you. That when
no
you
problem.
Listen to the data report, you have a good chance of hearing Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net.
That is
Zafar, thank you very much for being with us. Now, you were one of the principal figures in a very important program that took place on the weekend, and it spoke of it called for public discussion and support of the people of Kashmir. And I congratulate you on calling that meeting, and because sitting there, attending it, I was very impressed with all the information and, of course, with the cloud over that information, which the cloud being hardly any discussion here in the New York Times, Globe Mail, exactly an issue we talked about earlier in the program. That there is this issue has been ignored, but it really cannot be ignored now based on what is taking place here. Could you talk to us about why you called the meeting, why this is urgent?
Yes, of course. Since July the 8th, there has been a renewed surge in people's protests against the continued Indian military occupation of Kashmir, which has been under occupation since 1947. But there have been periodic upsurges in people's protests. And since the latest upsurge and the fact that there have been so many people that have been killed in the last 4 months, at least 100 people have been killed. Thousands of people have been injured, and in fact, there are thousands of others that have been blinded or, have suffered injuries to their eyes because the Indian forces are using what are referred to as pellet guns. These are steel pellets tipped with rubber, and they are fired into people's faces or bodies. And when they hit their faces, particularly their eyes, of course, they go blind. Regrettably, there hasn't been much coverage of this in the media here. In fact, as far as I can tell, there have been only one or two reports in our media. One report appeared in August in the Toronto Star, August 21st, I believe, which was basically taken from the Associated Press, so it wasn't even the Star's own report. Mm-hmm. And then there have been periodic reports. There was one report in the New York Times on August 29th. But other than that, there has been generally silence regarding this huge tragedy that is taking place there where people are being brutalized. And it's not an insignificant area because the total Kashmiri population is something like 16 million, out of which 12 million are on the in the Kashmir that is under Indian occupation. And of course, given the fact that India has 700,000 military personnel, another 70,000 or so what are referred to as Central Reserve Police Force, and then another 53,000 police force. So we are talking about more than 800,000 heavily armed troops in that small area terrorizing the Kashmiri population. And mm-hmm. and of course, there is a long history to the Kashmiris' struggle. They basically want to have the right to hold a referendum. So we felt that it was important to call that meeting to draw attention to the ongoing tragedy of the Kashmiri people and to demand of our own government here in Canada, which was incidentally on the Security Council back in 1948 and 49 when this issue had come before the Security Council, and the Security Council had voted unanimously. Of course, there were three abstentions. There was no opposing vote against or against this resolution, but that resolution specifically called for holding a referendum in Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was in the beginning of 1948, then 1949, 50, 51. The last resolution that was related to Kashmir was in fact in June of 1998. So in fact, there are a number of Security Council resolutions that call for holding a referendum, but for some reason, India adamantly refuses to do so, and what we refer to as the international community is turning a blind eye to this long festering problem that has, of course, spawned a number of other problems in the region.
Yes, and incidentally, well, now it does seem to it's been moving like to a new stage here, right? Because of the presence, I think you mentioned the Indian troops number 700,000, and a population that does not want them there. There has been resistance, and there was a young man who was martyred there. They seem to have moved to a new stage, which you would think that this would come back to that original UN finding.
Yes, absolutely. The young man that you are referring to, he was a 22-year-old young man. He was killed on the night of July the 8th together with two of his colleagues. They were actually ambushed and then killed execution style. They could have been captured if the Indian army wanted to, but they actually wanted to kill him. And in fact, when they killed him, the next day or that very night, there were very sort of jubilant announcements on Indian television to say that we have got this man and we have got rid of him, etc. Mm-hmm. Because his name was Burhan Wani. He had become very popular in Kashmir because he was media savvy. He was using the social media. He had become something of an icon for the resistance movement. And when he was killed the very next day, on July the 9th, when his funeral was being held, 200,000 people or more people turned out for his funeral. I mean, that was an incredible display of support for this young man who was martyred, and a tight slap in the face of the Indian occupation forces. In fact, there was a curfew imposed, but the people defied the curfew, and naturally, the Indian army shot at them. 23 people were killed, even in the funeral procession, and scores of other people were injured. And this has continued. There has absolutely been no let-up in the protests that people are holding over there. They are doing it with bare arms. They don't have any weapons with them, but mm-hmm. they defy the curfew. They come out into the streets. The youth hurl stones at the heavily armed troops, and of course the troops fire at them either live bullets or pellet guns or tear gas shells. And as a consequence, as I mentioned, something like 15,000 people have been injured. And there have also been thousands of people that have been arrested, kidnapped from their homes, and held without any knowledge of their family as to where they are being held. Naturally, no charges have been leveled against them, much less a trial. So what has happened is that once again, the people of Kashmir have shown that they do not wish to have anything to do with India. They want their right to self-determination. They want to have a referendum. And the fact that India has tried to subdue them for 70 years and it has failed, and now this whole thing has come back again with such vehemence, indicates that the people are just absolutely fed up with the Indian occupation. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if this issue is ignored by the international community, by the United Nations, by the major powers, then it has a very, very serious risk of escalating further and engulfing the entire region in a major conflict, yes. And which would be disastrous. But one of the tragedies that I have observed over the years is that the United Nations and other bodies simply act as a fire brigade. If there's a crisis, they rush over there to try to douse the fire, and then they all go home and forget about it mm-hmm. without looking at the causes of why the fire occurred in the first place.
Yes.
And, of course, the basic issue in Kashmir is that the people of Kashmir do not wish to be part of India. I think 70 years of resistance should be enough to prove to the world that they have voted with their feet. They are, mm-hmm. in fact, holding a referendum with their feet.
Yes.
And if physically they are not able to hold that referendum because of the occupation army, it does not mean that they have accepted that situation or that they would be cowed down by this massive, massive Indian military presence over there.
Yeah. This is the voice of Zafar Benghash. It is crescent-online.net, and there is excellent editorials and comments at that site about this issue. And again, Zafar, you, of course, reminded everyone, and it is just simply a fact. This has to do with, of course, the devolution, that didn't devolve, I guess, of the British Empire, which dates are the same for Palestine as for Kashmir.
Yes, exactly. In fact, during the program, I had mentioned this, that regrettably, many problems in the world can be traced directly to British colonial intrigue. Wherever they set foot and wherever they were forced to leave, then instead of leaving in a manner that there would be no problems left behind, the British work hard to deliberately create problems. Hmm. And Kashmir was one of those problems that the British deliberately created. Of course, Palestine was the other. And one of the speakers at that conference, where you also spoke, incidentally, and I might add, you spoke very eloquently. People were very impressed by your presentation. Ken Stone from the Canadian Peace Alliance actually addressed this issue of the similarities between the Indian occupation of Kashmir and Israel's occupation of Palestine. And these are, of course, both problems that can be traced directly to British intrigue, and they left these unexploded bombs in the region that continue to create havoc with the lives of the people over there.
Yeah, an unexploded foreign policy. They revisit. Thank you very much for that. I was, as I said, very impressed that this matter was so eloquently addressed by so many people there, but also just the fact we're talking, what is it? Is it 12 million people, would you say, the population in Kashmir?
The total population of Kashmir is 16 million,
16.
But 12 million are under Indian occupation. And I'm glad that you raised this point, because I also wanted to point out that the Kashmiris that live on the Pakistani side, there have never been any protests or any uprisings. In fact, the Kashmiris that live on the Pakistani side, one of the most remarkable things about them is that their literacy rate at 72% is about 20% higher than the national average in Pakistan. So that is how dedicated these Kashmiris are.
They've thrived.
They thrived, absolutely. Their economy is thriving, literally hundreds of thousands of Kashmiris from that region, the Pakistani side, they have settled in Britain and other parts of the world. They have, a couple of years ago, we had invited two members of the British House of Lords, Lord Nazir Ahmed and Lord Qurban Hussain. They both happened to be from the Pakistani side of Kashmir, whereas, the people from the Indian side, unemployment is something like 50% over there among the youth, when 72% of the population in the Indian side of Kashmir is under 30 years of age. So unemployment is a major problem. And of course, with this continued military occupation, since tourism is the sort of main source of earning for the people on the Indian side of Kashmir, when there are troubles, there is an army of occupation, there are checkpoints every few hundred yards, obviously tourists are not going to go into that area. So the people on the Indian side of Kashmir, regrettably, are suffering tremendous dislocation. And just to sort of conclude, in the last 4 months, there has been virtually round-the-clock curfew. Now, you can imagine what impact it is going to have on the lives of the people. Food has declined, obviously, because no food can be imported. Medicines are in desperately short supply, and people's lives have been turned absolutely miserable because they are locked down inside their homes. And, of course, the only people that come out are the youth that, defy the bullets and the guns and the tear gas shells to protest their anger or express their anger at the occupation forces over there.
Mm. Well, I'm convinced, based on what I'm reading and seeing, is that this matter is not going, obviously not going away, but it might be quickly moving to center stage. And of course, by the way, you point out, and we all should remind everyone, we're talking about nuclear-armed states who are have a difference of opinion here. So the other states of the world ought to be a little more vigilant and to do their duty by actually demanding that the 48 resolution be acted on, which is a plebiscite, which is democratic and is and to be solved without an army being present.
Exactly. In fact, that resolution specifically called for, first of all, of course, the ceasefire, which was you know brought about, and then it said that the armed forces that have entered that region should be withdrawn. Now, here is the situation. Pakistan agreed to that and it withdrew its forces. Mm-hmm. India refused to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a consequence, this problem has continued. And, of course, the other aspect was the holding of the referendum. And the resolution said that these armed forces should be withdrawn from Kashmir so that international observers can come and make arrangements for a referendum. So India refused, and as a consequence, these international observers cannot come, and even if they come, you can't hold a referendum under the shadow of guns and bayonets.
No, by the way, I think that's an agreed principle amongst people who advocate, you know, self-determination and democracy. You cannot have soldiers and police at all the street corners and then say you're having an election because that's intimidation, and it's just too problematic. It means this process is spoiled.
Exactly. And, you know, one other point that I think our listeners should keep in mind, and that is that India claims to be the largest democracy in the world. And one would have thought that a country making such a claim shouldn't have a problem with holding a referendum in a region that is internationally recognized as a disputed region, not part of India. Kashmir has never been part of India, and yet the so-called largest democracy in the world is afraid of holding a referendum in Kashmir. Because India knows, incidentally, that if there were a referendum, the Kashmiris overwhelmingly would vote to not be part of India. And they would want to join Pakistan because they can see and they know and they understand that their brethren on the other side of the what is referred to as the line of control, they are happy, they are prosperous, they are thriving, they are doing well, and the people under Indian occupation also would like to be in that situation.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Now, it's Zafar Bengash, and it's crescent-online.net. We have to ask you about this the burning issue of Syria, and I guess I better say Syria and Iraq. The Western media has agreed that the terrorists are in Mosul and that the city needs to be liberated. In Aleppo, everybody agrees that the terrorists are there, but they don't seem to be so enthusiastic about the city being liberated. And could you talk about these two cities? Who are the forces? I think we spoke to you earlier, but it seems to me in Mosul, there's a lot of special problems attached to the struggle there because not all the elements who are now encircling the city are actually in agreement with each other about what they want.
You are absolutely right. In fact, in Mosul, you have the Iraqi army that is conducting its operations from the southeast of the city, and then you have the Kurdish forces. They are referred to as Peshmerga, which means the, you know, frontline fighters willing to die. They are coming from the northeast. And then you have the Americans and the Turks also involved in it. And the Iraqi central government has repeatedly demanded of Turkey to withdraw its forces from Iraq's territory because these forces have come in illegally without the permission of the Iraqi government. And an additional complicating factor is that while the operations are taking place from the northeast, south and southeast, the westerly exit from Mosul is still open, which means that these terrorists can escape from the city and the province and head straight towards Syria. And I have the feeling that both the Turks and the Americans are actually there in order to facilitate this. Mm-hmm. And there have been reports, confirmed reports, that not only these terrorists, but also their families have been evacuated from here, and they have gone to Raqqa, which is the border town, which is supposed to be the second sort of secondary capital, because Mosul was the first capital of these terrorist groups. Raqqa in Syria is the second capital, and they're all congregating over there. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, Aleppo, which is further west of Raqqa or northwest of Raqqa, in a portion of Aleppo on the eastern side, these terrorists are holed up. And when Syrian and Russian forces carry out operations, there is immediately hue and cry against that, alleging that, well, they are killing civilians and this and that, etc. Whereas in Mosul, there is no problem about killing civilians or bombing them, whatever. Mm-hmm. But now an operation has started against Raqqa as well. But again, it's problematic because the forces that are involved in the operations against Raqqa are Kurdish forces. And Turkey is opposed to that because Turkey does not want the Kurds in its territory and the ones in Iraq and Syria to link up with each other. So here we have a problem between Turkey and the United States. The U.S. is backing the Kurdish forces attacking Raqqa, but Turkey is opposed to them, whereas both of them are cooperating with each other to facilitate the exit of the terrorists from Mosul to allow them to flee to Raqqa. So it's just an absolute mess over there, which indicates that, regrettably, all of this talk about fighting against terrorists, etc., is just not credible, because there are, you know, countries and groups, etc., that want to keep these terrorists on their side. And of course, these terrorists operating in Syria are financed by regimes like Saudi Arabia and Qatar that are close allies of the United States, and they want to keep them there because their aim is to somehow overthrow the legitimately established government of Syria. They have failed so far, but they haven't given up on their nefarious designs to overthrow a legitimately established government in Syria.
I want to ask you about the reporting is so awful that it isn't noted that a decision not to bomb eastern Aleppo in order to defeat these terrorists was taken by the Russian and Syrian governments. They've extended it. They've offered corridors, which when they do offer the corridor, the terrorists fire on it so as the people cannot leave. These things, this has taken place, has it not, for almost, it's been almost 2 weeks of this high tolerance of the presence of a terrorist group. And here there is no media discussion of that. As a matter of fact, they treat it almost the opposite.
Yes. That's exactly, the situation that both Russia and Syria not only offered to have a ceasefire, but they actually implemented a ceasefire so that these relief convoys could go into eastern Aleppo to provide food for the people that are trapped there, and also to enable the people to leave from there. And yet the terrorists over there are refusing to allow the people to leave because they are using them as human shields. And number two, they wouldn't allow any food to get into eastern Aleppo. And then they say, well, look, people are starving over here. Well, as far as the terrorists are concerned, they're not starving. So what is happening is that they are stealing all the food for themselves, and they are deliberately starving the people and then blaming Syria and Russia on the situation. Mm-hmm. So they won't allow these people to leave,
and any food convoys that try to enter eastern Aleppo, the terrorists fire upon them. They have destroyed a number of trucks. They have killed people. This is all well documented, well established, and yet, regrettably, there is so little mention of these things. Quite the contrary, anytime there is any problem with the civilians in eastern Aleppo or in the rest of Aleppo city and province, it is immediately blamed on the Syrian government and the Russians. Mm-hmm. There is gross distortion of the reality of the situation on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And one matter, if I can just quickly on it, I just can't let this go by since there's going to be a vote tomorrow involving Mr. Trump and Hillary. I was watching a central figure in the Hillary's campaign, and his name is Howard Dean. This past summer, he attended a gathering in Paris of an Iranian terrorist guerrilla group who is led by a kind of a cult figure. I don't remember her name.
Yes. Now, her name is Mariam Rajavi.
Now, she gave a speech, or he did, rather, me, at that gathering, saying, when Hillary gets in, you will benefit. She's your best friend. Now, could you tell us who they are and what, why that people voting tomorrow ought to know about that?
Yes, this group, the Mujahideen, it's called the Mujahideen Khalq Organization. Until about 2-3 years ago, this group was on the U.S. terrorist list. Until 2-3 years ago, because this group was involved in horrific crimes inside Iran. They were involved in bombing campaigns. They were planting car bombs. They killed a lot of civilians. Of course, many leaders of Iran after the revolution. And yet, regrettably, this group maintained offices a few blocks away on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., and a number of American congressmen and women were supporting this terrorist group. And of course, 2-3 years ago, the U.S. took them off their terrorist designated list. And as you mentioned, there was this meeting in Paris a few months ago, and all kinds of unsavory characters were there. Howard Dean was there, Rudy Giuliano was there, and also the former Saudi intelligence chief, yes, Turki Al-Faisal was there, and a number of other unsavory characters, and they all told them that, you know, we are going to support you, we will support your struggle. They were openly supporting terrorists over there. Yep. And this woman that claims to be the leader of this thing, because her husband, Masood Rajavi, it is believed that Masood Rajavi was killed, but this woman now is leading this so-called organization that has incidentally no support whatsoever in Iran. It basically is a bunch of terrorists that are involved in terrorist activities, and they want to overthrow a legitimately established government in Iran through acts of terrorism. And if Hillary Clinton were to be elected tomorrow, regrettably, a lot of, you know, I mean, she's on record. She is also, she's a woman who is, yeah, all gung-ho. She's with the militaristic wing of the Washington establishment. She was the one responsible for the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya. She is the one who has said that she would go ahead and bomb Syria and all kinds of other terrible things. So I'm afraid, if she were to be elected, and it seems likely that she might be, then I think the world is going to face a lot of problems.
There will be big trouble.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Zafar, you have answered all of our questions very eloquently. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Sure.
Take care.
Sure thing.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This is the Taylor Report. Remember, next week we're going to build this station and build the program, so be sure to tune in and support us.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
For the party, everything. For the people, nothing. It is, to say the least, somewhat disturbing to see how impassioned are the President and the First Lady in bringing out the black vote for Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. One wonders where that passion was during the 8 years of a blue riot against black life. Barack Obama rarely summoned the energies we've just seen to speak out against the vicious repression of black people, often at the hands of white cops. Nor has Michelle been heard on this score. They have been largely quiet, controlled, sedate even, and given the white madness and hatreds bubbling in millions of American hearts, we can understand that sedateness, that quiet reserve. It smells like fear. But those latent energies have been unleashed, and they are now rushing like rivers to Republican candidate Donald J. Trump. For many black millennials, the prospect of voting for a Clinton is about as attractive as cuddling up with a rattlesnake. They know of the Clinton sponsoring of mass incarceration, their ferocity regarding juvenile so-called super predators, and the Clinton embrace of the anti-habeas corpus law, the AEDPA, a law, by the way, that even some Republican jurists, like Ninth Circuit Judge Alex Kaczynski, who in a recent Law Review article called for its repeal, writing, "It is a cruel, unjust, an unnecessary law that effectively removes federal judges as safeguards against miscarriages of justice." For the millennials, they don't hear the entreaties, the pleas, or the promises of Obama. They've lived through 8 years from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, I didn't have one drop of liquor because I was too, I was just like, I only drink when I'm happy.
What the hell is this?
Oh, my God. He was the symptom.
Oh. Yeah. Oh. America is the disease. Here we go.
You know, 100 things that have been allowed to transpire.
Yeah.
from disenfranchisement to disenfranchisement.
I think, yep. I think I heard something on Roland Martin, something like 12% of black men voted for Trump and maybe 9% of black women. Crazy. So there are people who could not bring themselves to vote for Clinton because they didn't trust her or it, Clinton is. And also, I think Bill did a bill, several bills again. You know, when he spoke out against Obamacare, it became a weapon for Trump. And I also, I've said this before, I think that in his heart of hearts, in his maleness, he did not want his wife to win. I don't think it's conscious. I think it's subconscious, but I think it's there. And I think it's kind of male ego. You know, he sabotaged her in North Carolina when she was running against Obama. When he came out and said the stuff about Obamacare, his mass incarceration in front of the Black Lives Matter folks. Like, I did this for y'all. Like, you know, little thing.
Yeah, it wasn't such a little spit in the face to tell people that their children deserve to be in prison.
What? Yeah, yeah.
And then,
and you know
they didn't deliver
her message.
They didn't deliver for any working class person.
Listen, NAFTA to pull Ohio and Pennsylvania out of her pocket. And there's truth there. Come on.
And there's truth that white supremacy is what you've said, mother's milk in America.
That's right.
And they are holding on. And they falsely point to people who look different than them as the one who's taken the stuff out of their pockets.
Taking their job.
And it's not. It's like the people, it's the 1% that's taking the money out of their pockets, not the people standing next to them.
Right. And he's a part of that. You hear me?
He's the worst part of it. He's the biggest con man that we've seen.
Yep.
But this
is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you one thing. It ain't boring.
Yeah, it's good for journalists, but that's too. Pardon me.
Yep.
But you can't say that on the radio.
They gave it to him. Mm. Listen, if they had played this thing straight instead of saying, all right, look at our ratings, you know what I mean? It'd be a different country. But, you know, like corporate greed was like, look at our bank books. We're killing them, you know. And there you go.
All right,
you take care.
Yeah, thanks for being there.
All right.
And you, I trust.
I like
that. Thanks, correctional
all right.
Coming, the words I never thought I'd say, President Trump, have become reality. In a remarkable campaign full of bile, hatred, fear, and loathing, guess what? Fear won. Hatred now gulps a glass of champagne. This campaign has been marked by scenes we have never seen before, by words we've never heard said on TV or radio, by screams about a rigged system, folks. When a billionaire shouts about a rigged system, you better believe it, because it is, but in his favor, not against him. Donald Trump has received billions of dollars in free cable and media coverage, which lifted his campaign from farce into solidity. After every campaign stop, the strains of a song, "You can't always get what you want," was heard,
It is now clear. You can't. Today, a new day dawns on America. As a curtain falls over the Obama presidency and Clintonism. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slade Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. No matter what anybody else says, that's who I am, and I'm sticking to it, all right? So there you are. All right, today's show is going to be packed, so I'm going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Fred Peabody, the director of a film called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. Before that, we will be talking with Revolution Club members Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, who have been at Standing Rock in North Dakota this past week. And that's people are following that. That's where the heroic actions of the resistors at Standing Rock in the face of escalating police attacks, armed company thugs, and government lies at all levels have put a spotlight on how this country is founded on the genocide of Native peoples and slavery. And we're going to be talking with Riley and Travis about all of that and what they've seen and what they're doing there. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did. Well, actually, it's the first part of an interview that I did with Heather Ann Thompson, who's written the first definitive history of the 1971 Attica prison uprising. Her book is just incredible. It's called Blood in the Water, and it tells the story of the uprising, including in all aspects of it, including the state's savage response to the prison uprising and the prisoners' decades-long struggle for justice. So without any more to do, let's just hear that interview now. On September 9th, 1971, nearly 1,300 prisoners took over the Attica Correctional Facility in New York. Holding guards and civilian employees hostage, the prisoners negotiated with officials for improved conditions. Shortly after the rebellion began, the prisoners issued a statement to the world about who they were and why they rebelled. L.D. Barkley, a member of the Black Panther Party and one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion, read the demands and the prisoners' statement.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971. But of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven at as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard of the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who enslave and exploit the people of America. Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite other people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
And while prison authorities kept telling the world that the prisoners were torturing and threatening the lives of the guards they held captive, the guards themselves told a different story, the truth.
What is your name, please?
Frank Droll.
What is your job?
Correction officer.
Now, we want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men.
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
But on September 13th, the state sent hundreds of heavily armed troopers and correction officers into the prison. They killed 39 men, hostages as well as prisoners, and severely wounded more than 100. Drawing from more than a decade of extensive research, historian Heather Ann Thompson sheds new light on every aspect of the uprising and its legacy. And she's done that in a book called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, I got so much to talk with you about because when I got your book and I started reading it and I thought, this is unparalleled, produced a very powerful work. And it's one that's astounding, eye-opening, and enraging all at the same time. What brought you here? What propelled you to write this book?
Well, it was a bit of a strange path there. I was by training a civil rights historian and a historian of cities and the labor movement. And I was sort of casting about for a new project after I wrote about the Detroit uprising of 1967 and that city. And I had always heard of Attica as this really important civil rights event behind bars. And it intrigued me. And I thought I would explore that and write a history of this civil rights struggle behind bars, not having any idea that it was going to prove to be a 13-year journey because the state of New York did not want that story told. And also, it was a prison story fundamentally. And so it kind of took me into this whole new world of research about prisons and our criminal justice system. And I think doing the book fundamentally changed the kind of history that I did, and also changed me. It was quite an extraordinary story that I felt compelled to tell.
How did it change the kind of history that you did?
Well, I think prior to working on Attica, I had thought about civil rights, and I thought about sort of urban struggles, particularly of Black folks in cities like Detroit or New York, as sort of the story. And I didn't quite understand until I did Attica the ways in which the criminal justice system and policing and containment and the very apparatus that we see the least of, because it's sort of hidden, prisons are hidden from view, were so important to the way politics unfolded in the period after World War II. And so working on Attica brought me into the history of the criminal justice system in a way that I had not really predicted, and probably will be something I'll always work on, you know, something that I will always be really interested in, because I now understand the way in which policies of policing and policies of prisons are so instrumental into the way our country operates and to the way folks live in so many parts of our country.
The thing about this, though, too, is it really is like, you know, like you said, you had heard about Attica and things like that. And actually, I'm old enough to have been present, you know, at the time of it happening, not at Attica, but there in the world. And I was a radical, revolutionary-minded student at the time. And, I mean, it blew my mind. But I also, when I picked up your book, you know, I realized how little I actually knew. And I knew quite a bit. And in fact, one of the people you write about, Dacajuea, John Hill, was a friend of mine. And so I knew some things about it, but I didn't know anywhere near what you found. And you did this. I mean, it really was a hidden history. And for even for people who, like myself, think, well, we knew about all this. You know, you found some things. But when you found some of these records, and this was kind of enticing to me, because you found these records and you said, okay, but they were impossible to actually, you know, pick up and use very, you know, fruitfully, because they were all heavily redacted. And we've all seen those things you get from the government that says, and then they said, and then the next 10 paragraphs are blacked out. But you were actually lucky. You say you ran into two extraordinarily lucky breaks that changed everything in terms of writing this book.
Yes. So part of what you say is was so central to the book, which is that we thought we knew a little bit about Attica, but it wasn't until I really began digging that I understood that we didn't really know much, because from the moment that this uprising happened, the state of New York was there front and center trying to change the story of what happened to Attica. So we didn't really know why there had been so much bloodshed there. We didn't really know how so many people had died after their civil rights and human rights rebellion, and yet no member of law enforcement ever did a day of time or even a moment in a courtroom. And so I was trying to figure out that story. In other words, what is it about the story that we don't know, and what is it that the state of New York is really hoping that we don't find? How did I know they were hoping? Because every time I tried to do a Freedom of Information request, it was denied, or as you say, heavily redacted. And so I was forced to rely on, you know, a lot of different avenues towards that research. I had to obviously talk to the survivors a lot, which was really important. You know, of course, the folks in the prison, both the prisoners and the surviving hostages, had been trying to tell this story for decades. And so I relied on their stories. I relied on the lawyers a lot and all of the litigation that they had tried to file against the state. And I had sort of been poking around, but I still couldn't get at that story of cover-up. How is it so much trauma could have happened there, and yet again, no member of law enforcement was ever held accountable? And that's where, as you mentioned, I just happened upon this real stash of records that were, you know, placed in a room in the Erie County Courthouse, because I think there'd been a flood or some water damage wherever they had been before. And person at the clerk's office allowed me to see them, probably not knowing how important they were, but they were very important because in those records were documents from the grand jury that had investigated the Attica retaking and uprising. There were state investigative documents. There were depositions. There were really, really important documents indicating, first of all, what the state did at Attica, also what the lengths it went to cover up the carnage at Attica. And so once I had that, I think I was able to write a book about Attica that even people who lived it didn't quite know. That is to say, what was going on behind the scenes. And it's a deeply disturbing story about protecting law enforcement at the highest levels of government. And you get to hear from Richard Nixon in my book as he congratulates Rockefeller on the brutal retaking of Attica. He has one question, which is, was this a black business? And Rockefeller says, indeed it was. And that's all he needs to know to justify the fact that 39 men were shot to death, hostages and prisoners alike, and 128 were shot so brutally that they were permanently scarred and maimed. And so it becomes a story not just about the rebellion, although that's a profoundly important and encouraging story, but it's also a story about major repression and how it happened, how it worked.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. Heather is an award-winning historian at the University of Michigan, and she's written on the history of mass incarceration and its current impact for the New York Times, Time, The Atlantic, Salon, Dissent, and a lot of other magazines, as well as various scholarly publications. She also serves on the National Academy of Sciences Blue Ribbon Panel that studied the causes and consequences of mass incarceration in the United States. And her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, was just nominated for a National Book Award. You know, I have to ask you this about the second part of that really remarkable thing that happened too, because I was really struck by that. I thought the thing of finding these records and stuff was very important. But then you talk about somebody calling you up and inviting you to come and see something, and it was like this big warehouse or something or a storage unit full of things that had been collected from inside the prison yard and inside the prison, which I thought, God, you talk about actually touching history, history that's been hidden and suppressed for so long. And here you have all of these things from, I couldn't describe what they were, whether they're bullet casings or they're bloody. In fact, yeah, you talked about L.D. Barclay's one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion, his bloody clothing left in there. And I thought, God, that must have been such a just mind blower to have to stumble onto that.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, it didn't, I mean, that, so what you're referring to is that in 2011, it was the 40th anniversary of the uprising. And I was, of course, still working on the book, and I'd done an op-ed in the New York Times about it. And meanwhile, the state police in New York, probably again, some hapless person who didn't quite understand the importance of Attica and its current resonance, donated, gave to the state of New York's museum a 30-foot Quonset hut, military hut, full of Attica artifacts. And what that was all of the things that had been in the prison on the day of the retaking that the state police had scooped up, hoping to use as evidence against the prisoners. And it had been sitting for 40 years in this barracks in upstate New York, handed over to the New York State Museum, and because I'd done this op-ed, they called me and said, could you come and tell us what we have? And of course, I immediately went. I was incredibly interested to see, and it wasn't so much that it changed the story, you know, as those records in the courthouse did, but it certainly humbled me as to the importance of this story and the trauma that the prisoners had suffered at Attica. There were, as you mentioned, the bloody clothes of prisoners who'd been shot to death and also the hostages who'd been shot to death. And, of course, my own records indicated that the state knew it was going to kill its own hostages. And so you just to sit there and hold those items was really emotional. And to pick up the pictures of prisoners' children that guards and police had just ripped out of the cells and torn up. So it wasn't, again, that it really changed the story, but it certainly made me understand the viciousness of the retaking of this prison rebellion and also the violence visited upon prisoners and hostages alike on that awful day on September 13th, 1971.
Those things, too, to me, they infuse what you write there. I mean, I felt like you put the reader, you took history and put somebody who's interested in history, just checking this out for the first time, or somebody who knows about it, and you put us right in the middle of something in a way that we could actually feel this. And I think that was, you know, part of being infused with the what you found in that Quonset hut. You get a sense, a living sense of history, which is, it's very important in relation to this book, especially in relation to now and what's going on in prisons in relation to all that now.
Well, I'm grateful. I hope that that is true, because I will say that, you know, one of the things that, that readers will feel, I think, when they read this is, I mean, there's certain parts of the story that are so overwhelming in terms of, for example, in the beginning, the unity that these guys experience, you know, to stand together across barriers of religion and barriers of race and language and stand together for basic human rights. I mean, that is a humbling story. And then the story of the retaking, which is so violent. And you know, I think it's hard to convey those stories. And so I feel like, you know, if readers can feel that as if they were in it, and I'm deeply grateful, because that, you know, I sort of feel like I wanted to take them along with me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I was perpetually moved by the story, even as I was writing it, for sure.
Well, let's talk about this. In your study of it, you know, it's kind of interesting, because you present this as like, you know, you're looking at this thing and the prisoners are going through, you know, whatever's happening. More or less, you get a sense of the routinism of being harassed and tortured through your daily life, you know, in terms of the kinds of things that people are getting beaten up, they're getting thrown into cells, they're getting, you know, locked down for reasons they don't even know. And all of a sudden, out of all this comes a very shaky moment where nobody's quite sure what's happening, what's going on in terms of the relationship between the guards, and are they going to be brutally attacking them, or what's going to happen. And so people go to, they go to breakfast, they come back. All of a sudden, the whole world turns upside down. Let's talk about that. What did you learn about what actually led to the rebellion?
Well, what I learned was that I think that Attica has lived on in public memory in really powerful ways as this sort of planned insurrection to stand together for human rights on the one hand, or the negative of that is the state of New York's version, which is it was a planned insurrection, meaning a conspiracy. And my research indicated that neither were quite true. It turns out that the guys in Attica had indeed been hoping and asking and really begging for better conditions. And they'd also been educating themselves and organizing in study groups in the yard. But the day that this all jumps off, it was actually down to a prison management decision. They had, the upper level prison administration had decided on that one morning of September 9th, 1971, to retaliate against prisoners for an altercation the night before by refusing them entrance to the rec yard, which meant locking them in this hallway with the guards who were taking them back from breakfast. But of course, they never told the guards either what was happening. And in that sheer panicked moment where the prisoners think further retaliation is coming, the guards have no idea what's going on. People begin to back away from each other, arming themselves, and then quickly it becomes a melee and confusion and really what I describe as a riot. That is to say, chaos and violence. And it just so happens that a key gate that kept that tunnel from the rest of the prison gave way, thus opening up the prison to these men and thus opening up the prison to the rest of the prisoners. And so that is chaotic. It wasn't planned. But here's what is remarkable, that out of those moments of chaos and violence, and, you know, indeed one of the guards gets completely overrun and beaten, and he will eventually die of his injuries. I mean, it's no joke, the level of chaos and fear and violence. But then the guys decide that, look, you know, this is an incredible opportunity to tell the world what, in fact, goes on behind bars. Of course, Americans are completely shut off from this universe that they fund, that is in charge of other human beings. And these guys knew that. And so they go to the yard and they quickly set up a really remarkable experiment in participatory democracy. They elect representatives out of each of their cells. They set up a tent city of a medical station and a food station. And they invite the media in to see their conditions and to see what they need to improve them. And they invite observers in to help negotiate with the state. They have hostages who are guards and civilian employees whom they protect over the course of what will be 4 days of negotiations for basic human rights that my book reveals were really an extraordinary moment in American history of unity. but one that will be dashed when the state of New York decides on a brutal, forcible retaking with state police officers who have been out there for 4 days, angry, passing out weapons indiscriminately, who are going to storm the prison, and that's when the bloodbath really begins, one that the state of New York knew it was about to affect. And so it's a story of highs and lows, for sure.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. Heather is an award-winning historian at the University of Michigan, and she's written on the history of mass incarceration and its current impact for the New York Times, Time, The Atlantic, Salon, Dissent, and a lot of other magazines, as well as various scholarly publications. She also serves on the National Academy of Sciences Blue Ribbon panel that studied the causes and consequences of mass incarceration in the United States. And her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, was just nominated for a National Book Award. You know, one thing that really struck me, too, is that when you're talking about what happened, what emerged among the prisoners, I thought that was actually really, that was phenomenal. It was really great. I mean, this whole idea, and it was captured, I think, in a little bit of a way by, I think it was L.D. Barclay, who was reading the statement, reading from a statement that the prisoners put together, which said, began with, "We are men, we are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such." And you look at that, and you juxtapose that with what these guards and the people who are running the prison and, you know, from Rockefeller on down, and what's happening with that. And frankly, from Nixon on down, he's talking about all the things that you were just saying about, you know, this is a black thing and it's, you know, whatever this is. And these people are really, you know, they're criminals and they're gangsters and they're always going to be that way. They're just one step above animals, if that. And that you have this thing developing in the yard where you actually have people coming up and they're debating and learning things. And yeah, there's still, you know, there's some rough edged people there, but there's also people who are striving in ways that I thought got concentrated, really, really intense ways, got concentrated in what you were just saying about how they actually took care of people, of the hostages that were held.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the most heartbreaking stories that is part of Attica is the way in which the prisoners believe that the state will at least value its own people, right? Its own employees, its guard employees, its civilian employees. And they count on the state's humanity to help them have these negotiations. And what is really clear is that if it comes down to taking a stand against black prisoners, of course, it wasn't just black prisoners. It was white, black, brown. But the state understands this as a black insurrection. And it's really clear that they will sacrifice anyone if it means effecting control. And that, there's just these moments in the book where the men are crying. I mean, they are weeping. They can't believe the level of brutality that is visited upon them. In fact, one of them later testifies, you know, something, it's in the book, something, you know, to the effect of, you know, as he's on the ground and there's a gun pointed at his head, and there's blood everywhere in the water and people are screaming and dying. And he looks up and he says, "I've never seen that much hatred in blue eyes." And this is the trooper who is just, and sort of, it's in this moment when you really realize that, you know, this question of humanity and who was more humane is completely upended. And I hope that readers are asked to kind of really rethink, well, who do we imagine is behind bars? Who do we imagine those people to be?
All right. Welcome back. That was an interview I conducted with the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And her name is Heather Ann Thompson. And that was part one of the interview I did. And we will be presenting the second part of this interview next week. So stay tuned for that. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Stomp Dance from Robbie Robertson, and it was taken from his album contact from the underworld of Red Boy. Now, we've had quite a difficult time hooking up with the members of the Rev Club that are out there in Standing Rock, but we've finally been able to do it, and they are joining us now. Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing a little better now that I'm hearing your voice. You're at Standing Rock. How long have you been there? What are you doing there? What brought the two of you there?
We've been here a week, and we came here to stand with the people who are standing up to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline, this pipeline that has the potential to poison the Missouri River and poison the Standing Rock Sioux people. And we've come here to stand with people, but also to give voice to people, to allow people to talk to the world about why this has to stop, why this pipeline must be stopped, and why people should come here. And we've also come here to talk to people about this revolution, that the world doesn't have to be this way. We could actually make a revolution to get out of this, and we've been spreading this document from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, how we can win. That's what we're doing here.
I want to get into that in a little bit, but one of the things I wanted to try and talk with you about first, before we get into that, is there are some pretty important and significant things going on there. This resistance of the people at Standing Rock is important in a number of ways, and I know you guys have written about this. Can either one of you speak to that now?
Okay, so yeah, we have been on the ground now for about a week, and we've met all kinds of people from all over the world, people who have put their, you know, regular lives on hold to be here, people who planned on being here for just maybe a couple of days or a week, who've stayed here for months. And there was a particular confrontation that happened yesterday that was really intense and really righteous, what happened the day before yesterday, where at Turtle Island, which is an island that DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, has occupied, and Native people were telling us that there are 12 burial grounds, sacred burial grounds on this land. And like I said, DAPL has occupied this land, and it's right on the edge of the main encampment. And so people righteously decided to go and try to get back that land. And people went unarmed and went over and had built a bridge across there, and to go and to try to get back that land and take over that land. And people went into the freezing cold waters after police had tore down that bridge, went into freezing cold water to demand that their land be given back to them. And one person just bravely decided to go do this, and then was followed by, ended up being about 50 people that did this. And this got national coverage, and there were police in riot gear macing and firing rubber bullets at these unarmed water protectors in the water. People, there were Native Americans who were in canoes who were going back and forth delivering blankets and coats and water and food to people. I mean, this was just incredible. The cooperation, the determination of people to do this, and up against twice as many riot police who couldn't even handle the mace when they got blown back in their face. I mean, they stepped back, they were falling apart. But anyway, it was a really, really incredible thing to see and to be part of, and to be able to document for people all over the world to see. And there's interviews also on revcom.us that people should read from the people who are part of this.
Now, Travis, in a way, there's a lot of things that are unprecedented about what's happening there. Particularly, even if you're just looking at the last 40 years, it's unprecedented. But there's actually more than that. As I understand from reading what you and Riley have written, and again, I want people to remember that you are members of the Revolution Club and that you went out there as members of the Revolution Club. And so you're joining with people that are taking up the struggle. And you're also doing what you said earlier, bringing revolutionary science to this. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I wanted to find out from you this unprecedented character of all these people coming together. There's different nations of Native people, and then there's people who aren't Native at all but are coming from all over the country to stand with them. Let's talk about that a little.
Something like 280 different tribes, indigenous tribes in this country, have come out in Canada, have come out in support of the Standing Rock Sioux, demanding that this Dakota Access Pipeline not be built. And within that, something like 200 of those tribes have been represented here at Standing Rock. And this is unprecedented. At no time in history have this many tribes come together. And within that, tribes, you know, that have historic beefs with each other, for instance, the Crow, who have historic conflicts with the Standing Rock Sioux, were one of the first tribes to come out in support of them. So this has brought together all kinds of Native peoples from across the country and across the world. We talked to indigenous people from Panama, from Bolivia, who have come here. And it's brought people from all over the world to stand, not just people from this country, but we've talked to people from New Zealand, an indigenous person, I believe they're called the Maori, from New Zealand, people from Australia, Austria, Germany, Norway. This is gathering worldwide attention that people are standing up here to stop this pipeline and to stand up to this concentration of genocide that's been perpetrated against the native peoples for 500 years.
Tell me this, man, because exactly what you were just talking about, and one of the things this has done is it's really shined a spotlight on the whole history of what has been done to native peoples for centuries, on many levels, to the people themselves, to the destruction of the environment that people are living in and depend on. This is unprecedented, reaching back to and revealing the genocidal history of what's been done to native peoples here.
Right. I mean, we're not that far. I forget the exact distance. We're not that far from the site of the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre, where 300 Sioux people who were unarmed, who were involved in the ghost dance, were shot down and murdered. And this genocide has continued to today with their attempts to build this pipeline, which has serious, serious potential to contaminate the water that the Missouri River, on which these people are dependent and many, many people downstream are dependent. This is part of the continuing genocide, and people are cognizant of this, and they're standing up and saying, no, this is not going to happen.
Let's go to Raleigh for a minute here. Raleigh, tell me this. You were mentioning the pipeline and what's been happening overall. The devastation of the environment, that's been a big part of what's going on. Actually, as I understand it, one, it's threatening to totally destroy the water supply for the native peoples. But it was moved originally from where it was going into cities, one of the big cities in North Dakota. It was moved because they were afraid it was going to threaten the water supply there. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. People are very outraged at this. People understand, well, wow, it was a problem when it was potentially going to go through Bismarck, but it's not a problem when it's going to go very, very close to native land and potentially threaten their water supply and just completely poison their water supply, which could ultimately lead to just total devastation of this whole people, this whole tribe. And this is part of what has compelled so many people from all over the world to come here. People are connecting this up with the whole devastation of the planet that is going on right now, the implications if this pipeline is allowed to go through here, and how this could further advance these kinds of things happening. And people are putting their bodies on the line to stop this. People from all over the world, because, yes, people are understanding. When we ask people, why are you here? They say to stop this pipeline, but also this is about humanity as a whole. People are really understanding that, making these connections, that if this isn't stopped, if these kinds of things are allowed to continue, then, you know, somebody said the other day, the planet could go on, but even as it is being despoiled, but humanity, the ability of humanity to exist on a planet like this that is just being poisoned left and right, that is incredibly at risk. And this fight is a concentration of that.
Let's talk about the police presence for a minute so people get an understanding of how large and threatening that is.
Wow, yeah, that is something people do need to understand. Every night when we're trying to go to sleep in this incredibly peaceful encampment, right? Although there's people every night also singing and doing dances and this kind of thing, which is beautiful. But at the same time, you hear helicopters and planes overhead constantly. And anytime people go out onto the road, which is blocked now from burned out vehicles, but also from tanks and National Guard and police have a constant presence there on this road that is not very far from the encampment. And they are constantly there. Anytime people come out onto this road to do a prayer, to do a walk, to do anything out on this road, they bring much more backup police. You see DAPL helicopters flying overhead at the same time as police helicopters fly overhead. I mean, yesterday when there was an action of clergy, about 300 clergy from all over the country, there were helicopters. It was just crazy when you see these religious forces who are coming and praying and singing on this road, and then you have at the same time on the opposite end of the road all these extra police forces coming in, the helicopters flying overhead. It is so outrageous.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Travis Morales and Riley Ruiz, who are two members of the Revolution Club who are currently in Standing Rock. So let's talk about this. You know, you're in Standing Rock. You're there. You're talking about all the things that have happened there. You're talking about the courage of the people, the determination of the people not to bow down in front of this continuation of genocide. But you also said in the beginning of the show that what's going on is you also came there to stand with the people and to be part of this, but you also came there bringing something. And in one of the articles you guys wrote, you talked about you're bringing revolutionary science to them. Let's talk about that, what you mean and what you're doing with that.
I mean, the main thing we've been spreading and getting out is this message from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, how we can win, how we can really make revolution. And we've been getting out to all kinds of people from around the world, people who live here. And in getting to this question of, look, the world doesn't have to be this way. We could make a revolution. And this document is getting into how, not just why we need a revolution, but what we need to do now to get prepared and how we could actually defeat them. And we're getting it out to different kinds of people, and it's being spread by some people. I mean, we've talked to some different people who told us that they've seen this already, that a friend of theirs brought it to them. In fact, one youth was telling us that he'd gotten the pamphlet and he read the very first paragraph and let out a whoop, and his horse rose up on its hind legs, and he dropped the pamphlet, and the horse stepped on it, and he wanted to get another copy of it. And there's people that we've been showing this to and reading sections of it to them, and there's a real openness among people about trying to figure out how we can actually get out of this. And we've been bringing the people that in reading this, getting into that. We have the science, the leadership, and the strategy in Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who's actually done the work. And people could go online and read about this, but also dig into this and dig into the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, how immediately on day one we would get into this. And, we've gotten a lot of different responses. Some people have been extremely excited because they've never heard anyone actually talking about how we could get out of this, that there's an organization they can go online to revcon.us and read about it. Others, it's much more controversial. There is this question of violence and do we need to be prayerful. So there's been a lot of good back and forth with people, and in particular pointing to, look, what's going on here is a concentration of hundreds of years of genocide against the native peoples, the poisoning of the planet, which we've been talking about. And this is all part of a system that cannot help but do what it does. It cannot not do what it's doing here at Standing Rock. It cannot not poison the planet. It cannot not have its police killing Black and Latino people every day and deporting immigrants and conquering and bombing people all over the world. And we need to, people who are questioning this and don't want to live in this kind of world, we're challenging people. Let's get into this and let's talk about what it's actually going to take.
All right, Travis and Riley, unfortunately, we have to go. We have another segment coming up, but I really wanted to thank you for joining us today. You're doing really good stuff there, and I really look forward to hearing more about it. Let's keep in touch, all right?
Right, and people should definitely go to revcom.us and read all the articles and interviews we've been doing with people.
That's right. They're very enlightening and very thrilling, actually. So take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Riley. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. Cover girl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pistols deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slang test tube babies to corporate crackheads. They flash logos and blast ghettos. Their embroidered neckties say, stop snitching. Conscious rappers and whistleblowers get snitches made of acupuncture needles and marionette strings. There is a war going on for your mind. Professional wrestlers and vice presidents want you to believe them. The desert sky is their blue screen. They superimpose explosions. They shout at you. Pay no attention to the men behind the barred curtain.
nor the craters beneath the draped flags. Those hoods are there for your protection, and the meteors these days are the size of corpses. There is a war going on for your mind.
We are the insurgents.
All right, welcome back. That was There's a War Going On for Your Mind from the Flobots. All right, I recently saw a film, and actually I saw it a couple of times because I liked it. And the film is something that really is dear to my heart. As a journalist, I spent most of my life as a journalist, and a journalist who really was aiming to constantly reveal the truth to people about all kinds of different things. And this film is just about that. It's about a person who sort of personified all that, I.F. Stone. And the film is called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. All right, and before we get into a conversation with the director of the film, Fred Peabody, I thought I'd give you a chance to hear the trailer. Check this out.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
When is the last time you heard CNN say the Pentagon is lying?
You know, we don't have state media in the United States, but if we had it, how would it be any different?
I think the media is really nihilistic. It's about making money. What makes money in this country happens to be avoiding difficult truths about our society.
Thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down.
You have to get rid of this ignorant and meddlesome majority, control them, make sure they do the right things, all for their own good, incidentally.
Congresswoman, let me interrupt you just for a moment. We've got some breaking news out of Miami. Justin Bieber has been arrested on a number of charges.
Good journalism today has the state in its crosshairs, and you never want to punch down. You always want to punch up.
I would say our mission statement is to produce adversarial, fearless journalism. The more power someone wields, the more journalistic accountability and scrutiny they need.
There are policies that have been enacted. There are bombs that have been dropped, as a consequence of which these millions of people are destitute in the way that they are. And we have to allow them to tell that story.
There's only two types of reporters. There's those who care and those who don't. Most of them don't care.
I'm amused at people who claim that the governments don't lie. Really? You know human beings that never lie? Of course they lie!
I tried to prove what I was saying from the horse's mouth, as it were, using the government's own documents.
I can draw a line from I.F. Stone directly to what I'm doing now.
I thought, how could the President of the United States be involved in something this dumb at the beginning?
Invade. We're being dumbed down, we're being watered down, and we're being told information which is false.
Make these people own this.
When the media acts as a conveyor belt for the lies, why it matters is because lies take lives.
I find in our own government documents nothing but lies.
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer from the film All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. And joining us now to talk about the film is the director, Fred Peabody. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
Give people a better sense of the film and then why you wanted to make this film, why you felt compelled to make this film.
Well, All Governments Lie is a famous quote by I.F. Stone, advice that he would frequently give to journalism students, you know, that you have to assume that they're lying and then go to the documents and find out if they are. Often he would find that when he did that, he would be able to expose the fact that the government was not telling the truth. And he operated this little four-page weekly, which he got subscribers to. I was one of them. When I was 19 years old and a kind of would-be investigative journalist, doing freelance work occasionally for the CBC, CBC Radio in Toronto, where I was living, a friend of mine told me, you should subscribe to this little weekly. I.F. Stone's weekly, it's the only place you can read the truth about what the American government's really doing, especially in Vietnam at the time, but other things as well. So he is kind of a legendary figure to the current crop of independent, investigative, adversarial journalists today, like Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, who are co-founders of The Intercept investigative website, people like Amy Goodman, executive producer and host of Democracy Now! many other people. Michael Moore, as you know, is in our film and says he can trace everything he's done in his career to the fact that as a teenager he subscribed to I.F. Stone's Weekly. We have Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein fame, who was reading I.F. Stone's Weekly from the age of 11 because his parents subscribed. And he would get it first because when he got home from school, his parents were still at work, and there would be I.F. Stone's Weekly. So anyway, he grew up on I.F. Stone's Weekly. And what is it about him that inspires all these people? It's the fact that he was doing solid, rigorous, investigative journalistic work and exposing government lies, and in some cases, corporate lies. As then, the mainstream media today, you know, largely owned even more so now by gigantic corporations, just a handful of them, they're not doing that job, especially in a time of war or in the period when a government is trying to stir up support for a war, as we saw in Vietnam, you know, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was what Johnson used to basically ramp up the war in Vietnam. I.F. Stone was the only guy to point out that there were a lot of discrepancies in the government story, and it appeared that maybe this so-called attack on a U.S. ship by Vietnamese PT boats didn't happen. But that was what Johnson used to get Congress to approve a major bombing campaign that ramped up the war in Vietnam. We saw the same thing happen in the run-up to war in Iraq, where even the vaunted New York Times was running planted false stories that had been planted in their paper by Dick Cheney, who then the next morning was on Meet the Press saying, well, hey, don't believe me. You know, look at the New York Times this morning. You know, Saddam Hussein is getting the parts to build a nuclear bomb. So we point out in the film that the mainstream corporate media are falling down on the job of keeping governments honest. And thank God we have independent journalists and outlets like Democracy Now!, The Intercept, a sort of younger skewing internet program called The Young Turks, which is based in Los Angeles and created and hosted by Cenk Uygur.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, when I.F. Stone did this, it wasn't, you know, he wasn't a curmudgeon. He wasn't somebody who was just like, ah, the hell with that. I know this is, you know, I'm just going to see where I can poke around and see what comes up. But he actually got, you know, you got a sense that he got enraged. There's a scene in the film where I think he's talking to Dick Cavett, and he's talking about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And he's laying it out. He's saying, look, this is what's going on. You look at this and you have to, you know, if you're really looking for to understand the world and what's happening, and if you need to have truth. At your access, you need to access the truth. And he was arguing that people have to do that. And that seemed to be a big thing with him. And this was no easy task. I mean, he did pay a price. For instance, although this was a kind of amusing price, he was banned from White House press conferences, which,
Yeah. Well, you know, not so much banned, but he just couldn't get accreditation. And, I mean, he was, you know, he didn't make a big deal of that. I mean, as he pointed out, because he was – nobody running a small newsletter of any kind was given White House press credentials. So it's not that he made a big deal of that, but it is a fact. But as Noam Chomsky says in our film, and Noam Chomsky became a friend of I.F. Stone's and certainly considers him, you know, one of the best reporters ever. But as he said, that was probably an advantage for Stone because he didn't have to go there and listen to a bunch of lies from the White House press secretary. And in fact, instead went and read through Senate transcripts, Senate hearings transcripts, and, you know, the congressional record and other documents that he could publicly access, if you know where to look, and prove what was going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that was also very interesting about him, it's sort of – he was working in a time, and if you think about this now, there's two parts to this, but one thing just observationally, there's, you know, he was working in a time where you make the full point in the film where basically he had to do a lot of hard research. He had to, it wasn't something where he could just like fall into, you know, maybe he had a source here and there who would turn him on to something, but basically when it came right down to it, he had to go and dig into things, and he had to actually look for truth versus whatever's, you know, whatever didn't quite sound right. And he had to actually then do the work to search it out. And that was a pretty dogged amount of work. And he really had to have sort of a pit bull grasp on what was wrong here. Something was wrong, and I got to find the answer.
Yeah, he was a voracious reader. He would pour over, as I said, the congressional records, transcripts of hearings, but also the foreign press. You know, he was a big fan of I think, Le Monde and other French papers. And he read other, you know, European newspapers. I mean, he was, because he knew that they had a different take from the American mainstream news media on U.S. policies in Vietnam and elsewhere. And he had a voracious appetite for information, and he also had the skills of what he would have said at the time, you know, that he considered himself a solid newspaper man. That was the term that he used. I mean, today we would just say a solid journalist, but he very much believed in, you know, the importance of, you know, doing the rigorous, authoritative research, finding the documents, in some case, finding the sources within government, although he wouldn't go to the high-level sources. He would go to the, you know, the people working away in the basement, you know, at some government department who no one ever talked to anyway, and get the truth from them. Yeah, and plus he wrote with a great deal of style and wit, and that's the other thing that made his weekly such a pleasure to read. I can't stress enough how great and eloquent a writer he is. But also the human values come through. As Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept says at near the end of our film, you know, you don't stop being a human being, and you don't stop caring just because you're a journalist. And as Chris Hedges says in our film, probably the most important thing about I.F. Stone is simply I.F. Stone cared. He really cared about people and about humanity.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Fred Peabody, who is the director of a really good new film called All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. Now, Fred, tell me this, man. It's interesting. The people that you brought onto there, one of the people that really I was attracted to, because it is somebody who is sort of down and dirty, and it's, and kind of, you know, the style he has in as a broadcast journalist is jank. You know, me, there was something in what he did that actually captured I.F. Stone. When he actually went and he had that thing about being very excited about finally getting like an MSNBC job, and, you know, then he was going to be able to do it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Cenk had built up quite a following with his online podcast and videocast called The Young Turks, which he does now as well, and has tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of subscribers. Some of them paying subscribers and others who get highlights for free on YouTube. But, as you know, he was quite successful at that and obviously good on camera. So MSNBC offered him a job to host a major evening slot on MSNBC. I guess they should have known what they were getting was not a yes man and not a guy who was going to be a conveyor belt for government statements and take them at face value. But as he said, he was called in by the head of MSNBC, and this is after about 6 months, I believe, who said, Cenk, I've just come back from Washington, and they're not happy with your tone. I mean, this is because he had the audacity to ask tough, hard questions of politicians, you know, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. And at the time, I think he was also having the audacity to criticize President Obama for things that he considered not very progressive policies, and yet coming from a guy who seemed to hold out the hope of being progressive. So anyway, they said, you know, just tone it down and you'll be fine, Cenk. You know, they actually said to him, which is funny, act like you were a senator, which is mind-boggling, but this is what goes on, even at a network that at the time was kind of portraying itself as mildly progressive.
Yeah, that is. It's funny, and it's also, it could be dangerous if you act like a senator or something. Who knows?
Well, as Cenk said, what does that mean? You want me to lie more?
empty my pockets. Empty. You know, you got some big bags of money. And sort of. When the people talk about act like a senator, I always think of that. What was that one where they had the FBI had filmed all these senators and congressmen stuffing money into their pants, into their pockets many years ago. Abscam, right? Abscam. Yeah, that was it.
Right.
You just couldn't get funnier on that. We're running out of time, but I want to get one more point from you, which is tell people why you think that I.F. Stone, who has been gone for quite a while now, but I.F. Stone why is it that people should pay attention to what he was, and then also what he gave to the world?
I guess to me, I.F. Stone, ever since I started reading his weekly when I was 19 years old, has kind of been bedrock for the kind of journalism that means a lot to me. I mean, there's an old saying, and it didn't come from I.F. Stone. I don't know where it came from, but yeah, I relate to it, which is that, you know, journalism should afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. I happen to relate to that, and I think that is exactly what I.F. Stone was doing. He was trying to expose injustice and to do it in a way that was backed up by solid evidence. To me, that's the definition of good journalism, and people should know that even though they haven't heard of I.F. Stone, you know, some of the people, particularly if they're following some independent media online, some of these people like Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, Amy Goodman, Nermeen Sheikh, David Korn at Mother Jones, they all are doing what they're doing because in many cases they were inspired by the work of this little-known guy, I.F. Stone.
And
by the way, I want to stress that there are a lot of laughs in this film.
Yeah, definitely. I was just going to say that. All right. And the film is All Governments Lie, Truth, Deception, and the Spirit of I.F. Stone. And Fred Peabody, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care, man. All right. And as we go out, I should point out that the film All Governments Lie is currently screening in a handful of cities across the country and in film festivals here and around the world. But if you want to find out more about the possibility of getting the film in your city or your area, go to the website allgovernmentslie.com and see if you can find a way to get hold of the filmmakers and see if you can bring the film to your city, because you don't want to miss this one, folks. All right, well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with There Must Be a Better World Somewhere from B.B. King. Talk to you again next week.
Sometimes I wonder just what am I fighting for?